It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. Larry Magid is here. Denise Howell, our favorite internet attorney. Owen Thomas is here from the San Francisco Business Times. We are going to talk about the amazing AI music, how far we've come, and how crazy AI is. It makes it possible to create a self-running propaganda machine for a little more than $100. The passing of a great physicist who changed our understanding of the world around us, and the FCC brings back net neutrality. All that and a lot more coming up next on A Great TWiT. Stay here.
Podcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 975, recorded Sunday, April 14th, 2024. You don't want to make Gandhi mad. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. Ooh, I love this show because I love this panel. Owen Thomas is back from the San Francisco Business Times. Hello, Owen.
Hello from non-zombified downtown San Francisco.
Yeah, it's hot. It's happening. It's hip. It's where all the cool kids are. They go to lunch at South Park. They watch movies at the IMAX, at the Metreon. They like to go into the Bank of America building for brunch, right?
Actually, the new hotness is IKEA's Sally Hall. It is plant-forward. It is... You know, it's got pop-ups. It's got Bergara Bar, where I had a Beyond Meat patty with some slaw and vegan fish roe, which I didn't even know was a thing, but it was tasty.
Do they ever do, like, Swedish meatballs with lingonberries or something, or, like, Impossible meatballs?
So there is an IKEA deli that's, like, in the IKEA store, but adjacent to the food hall, and they've got your plant balls, they've got your regular Swedish meatballs. They're not pushing the plant like so heavily that you can't get a Swedish meatball, because I think if you shop at IKEA and you don't have a plate of Swedish meatballs with lingonberry sauce, the universe folds into itself.
It is the greatest.
And if you shop at IKEA, you'll never get out of IKEA. My only problem is it's easy to get into an IKEA. Have you tried getting out of one? You have to walk the entire store.
Yeah, they're clever that way. That's Larry Magid, president and CEO of Connect Safely, longtime CBS radio commentator. Great to have you, Larry. And I heard the distaff sounds of the wonderful Denise Howell, attorney at large, hearsay culture.
Discordant distaff, I'll take it off.
I've learned that distaff, which for years I used as kind of commonplace way of referring to women, is very, very demeaning. So I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that anymore. I apologize. I thought I was being literary or something. Anyway, good to have you all. We've been playing before the show, and I apologize ahead of time because every musician in the audience goes crazy. But this week, two AI-generated music sites just took off. One's been around for a while, Suno.com. In fact, I think it's related to OpenAI because Microsoft offers it in their Copilot Bing plugins. And then another one called UDIO, which I just realized is audio without the A, or studio without the ST. It's both of them are, in this case, generating music.
There's one simple bit.
I was going to UDIO and I wound up generating sound.
But what's impressive about these, and this has been, look, there's the naysayers who say, yeah, of course, for AI to generate art or music, which is kind of imperfect by design and not, you know, hard to measure its success, these are perfect choices because a hallucination in a song or a hallucination in art, you know, just looks interesting as opposed to hallucination when you're writing a pleading for the Supreme Court, which is not interesting, but in fact offensive to the court, is a little bit more challenging. But I have to say, I'm very impressed by both of these. Now, Benito, who's an actual musician, says what they're, you say they're not musical.
It's not art.
It's not art. Well, we know it's not art. It's AI. Any more than an AI short story is art, right?
Yeah. I mean, then if it's not for art, then it's pretty much disposable music, right?
Well, a lot of music these days is disposable. You ever been to a Las Vegas casino? I
absolutely agree with that.
Here is a German klezmer from Suno. And by the way, not only can it play in different styles, it can speak different languages. Now, you may say that's not musical, but if that showed up on my Pandora playlist, I would not immediately go, oh, there's something wrong with my radio, right? That's Suno. I think Suno does a marginally a better job than Udio. This is Udio, "You Spilt a Coffee on My Dog." Okay, that's terrible.
Bad example.
And I think that's a philosophical question as to whether it's art. I mean, by Webster's definition of art, I suspect it isn't art. I think Benito may be right. But
what is art anyway, right?
What is art? I mean, if it creates things that we enjoy watching, listening to, reading, is it not art? I don't know.
Here's the thing that is kind of blowing me away. So I played with Suno last December on Windows Weekly, and we made a Christmas song. I'll play a little bit of it because it's too much, too horrible to listen to much of.
I've heard worse things on radio.
Yeah, especially at Christmas time.
Yeah, really.
It's just, it's not, it sounds like a robot.
Mm-hmm.
Fast forward literally 4 months later, and it's making, well, I'll play something, I'll play some stuff I made earlier for our shows. Jeff Jarvis wanted me to make a song about Cacio e Pepe.
In a humble abode in the heart of Rome, where artisans of pasta find their home, I set the stage with flour, eggs, and water to create a dish that's beyond the
borders. That's pretty good. It's written an opera about Cacio e Pepe. And it does this in under a minute, right? I mean, you might say, well, yeah, obviously it's under a minute, but I'm pretty impressed. This is a song I wrote for our friend Craig Newmark of Craigslist. He's a pigeon fancier. In fact, he's taken his vast fortune that he made on the backs of putting newspapers out of business with their classified ads. No, that's, sorry, Craig. The vast fortune he made out of a really useful tool called Craigslist, and is one of his charities. He has many charities, including some good journalistic charities. But one of them is pigeons. He likes pigeons. So I wrote him a song.
In the land of the internet, there was a man named Craig. He had a passion for pigeons like no one could explain.
Now that's good harmony.
He sailed the west vast ocean in search of pigeon lore. His love for these feathery friends forever to explore.
I asked it for a sea shanty. Oh,
I was going to say.
Newmark, pigeon man, you sail the
now, all I'm saying is, in 3 months, very noticeable progress to the point where, okay, maybe, you know, when you look at Stable Diffusion or Midjourney, if you look closely, you might see some weird things that you go, well, that's probably an AI. I'm not saying they're perfect. I'm not saying they're duplicating human effort, but I am impressed. Am I wrong to be impressed?
I want to know how much computing power this is consuming.
Oh,
like how many?
Oh, the lights went down in Boston when I did it. I mean, I'm sure a ton, right? This is completely untenable from an environmental point of view.
How many trees should Leo now plant? That's
yeah, exactly.
My question.
Yeah.
That's an excellent point. I don't know. Are we going to put all of the crypto universe out of business and salvage this music? I mean, somebody's out there using cycles anyway, so.
Yeah, and all AI is, well, we know this, and this is a problem. And I think
it's a problem.
Because it costs these companies money, they are strongly incented to solve this. That's one of the reasons I think there's a push for on-device AI and so forth. I don't know how much this uses, but you're right. I'm blithely spending on my children's future to make sea shanties about Craig Newmark. I admit it.
Well, and so much of it is venture backed, right? So
right, like, it's funny money. Yeah.
Like when AI gets into real economics, it's kind of like when you suddenly discovered you couldn't get a Lyft in downtown San Francisco for $2.99 anymore.
Yeah. It also depends on whether their servers are using coal or hydro or other renewables right. to generate the power. So, I mean, in theory, we might be able to make that up with renewables. But you're right. I mean, AI is, you know, I remember in the early days of computers, remember the paperless office?
Oh, yeah.
And the promise that computers were going to save us so many of the world's resources. And I don't think it turned out quite that way.
No. Yeah. Setting the admittedly problematic energy use aside, I guess the thing that I'm most interested in is AI is making progress in very interesting leaps and bounds. Yes. Yeah. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely.
No? Is it yet? It's not. Look, I think it's a mistake to say we want AGI. We want general intelligence. I don't think we need or want that. And maybe we won't even be able to get that. Yeah. But is it useful?
Well, Leo, like you, I've been at this technology beat for, in my case, over 40 years. And I've seen a handful of major paradigm shifts, and this is definitely one of them, on par with the World Wide Web. I guess I'd put the Mac as one of the paradigm shifts, or the graphical interface. This is huge. I mean, I've seen more progress in the last year in many ways than I've seen in the last 10 years. So I would agree with you. I think, you know, not just this, but all of the AI products that we're seeing are blowing me away. You know, it kind of makes covering tech interesting again, frankly.
Last year, there was a story about DeepMind, Google's AI, the one that, you know, created a chess-playing machine that could beat Garry Kasparov, and a Go-playing machine that could beat Lee Sedol. It found 2.2 million crystal structures in materials science, which is 45 times larger than the number of different crystal kinds we've unearthed in the entire history of science. Now, that was the story in November. The story that came out this week is, yeah, but most of those crystals, no big deal. Like, ho-hum. And I guess in a way, that's kind of the whole story of AI in general. It comes up with this amazing stuff, but maybe it's not going to change the world. I don't know.
No, I think it is. I think it's going to get integrated into so much of what we do that, you know, the whether it's music and art or, you know, discoveries, like you were saying, crystals or medications or compounds, crystals that could become medications, right? I mean, it's connecting the dots in ways that are faster and more comprehensive than we're able to do on our own.
Yeah. And I'd argue the ho-hum is actually what AI is really good at. Like,
you know, That's true.
Yeah, AI and drug discovery, you're like, you know, it's kind of like those 2.2 million crystal patterns. Like, you just need to identify as many compounds as possible and then figure out which ones might have therapeutic applications. And, you know, like, that's always been a computer-assisted process in modern times, but AI is kind of supercharging that. You know, even in journalism, I read a really great essay by Zach Seward, the co-founder of Quartz, about kind of what is the real use of AI in journalism. And it's not about generating stories. It's about, say, taking a data dump, a leak of like millions of financial files,
right,
a la the Panama Papers, and finding patterns like what are the common LLCs? What are the common entity names that are shared across these files? Because you could do that by hand, it would take centuries. So you can do investigations much more efficiently. You can do investigations realistically that you could not have done 5 years ago, 3 years ago, even 1 year ago.
Right. And that applies in the legal field, in so many fields where data, you know, and making sense of data is a huge job that is overwhelming for humans on their own.
Yeah. And not to mention diagnostics. I mean, some of the things that we're going to see in medicine are going to blow us away. I mean, it's already beginning. We're going to just see a lot of that. I mean, I have a feeling the idea of a radiologist looking at an X-ray is going to become so passe within a very short time when AI can analyze an X-ray and, you know exactly what it's looking at.
But I suspect the radiologists will need to know, like, oh, this AI model always misidentifies this right. kind of tumor and, right. you know, and knows how to, like, enter a prompt that, like, deals with those, you know, quirks of the system. You know, that's where the radiologist's right. expertise will move.
Right. And sadly, there'll probably be people some people will die between now and the time they get it right. And they'll never have it 100% right. I mean, so it's not going to be a smooth, everything's perfect. But where it's going is very impressive, very promising.
I think this deep mind crystal research is almost a template for what is happening everywhere, which is in November, Google comes out. They say we've created 380,000 new crystal structures, more than humankind has created in all the history of science. And then a month or two later, this is the article that came out this week in Chemical Materials. They took a random sample of the structures and say none of them meet the three-part test that material scientists care about: credible, useful, and novel. So they've came up with a lot of junk. Now, I'm willing to bet that somewhere in those 380,000 of crystals, there are some new crystals that are credible, useful, and novel. We don't know yet. Scientists haven't gone through all 380,000. But I think that is a template for what we are seeing now, and a way to temper our expectations. We, you know, I've watched AI because I've been through a few AI winners in my time, and as you have too, Larry, I'm sure. You guys are too young, but Larry and I remember, you know, the big hype about AI that first happened in the 50s and then the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. And in every case, our hopes were dashed, and it turned out Eliza wasn't all that good at being a psychotherapist.
I remember Eliza.
Yeah.
I remember that well.
Hey, I'm old enough to have hand typed Eliza code.
There you go.
In BASIC into my Apple II.
But even at that point, we all had realized, yeah, this is trivial and not that useful. But I think what's happened this time is we're starting to see some amazing things like the music I just played for you. As long as we understand what the limits are and we don't get to this point where we can say it's going to replace humans or it's going to be as smart as humans, maybe it will, I don't know. But it already is incredibly useful if you temper your expectations, right?
Right. And I also don't think it's going to destroy humankind the way some people are claiming as well. That's the other hype around this. So, you know, we're seeing the positive hype and the negative hype. I think it's going to be, you know, there's going to be problems and there's going to be great successes, but it's not going to change the world overnight. But boy, it's taking us in some really amazing directions.
I predict we'll look back on the AI doomers and we'll realize, at least for some of them, like Sam Altman and Elon Musk, it was a way of hyping AI.
Oh, absolutely.
It was like, oh, this is so good, it could destroy humankind. Watch out.
And also, trust us.
We know what we're doing.
Yeah. The new guys, the startups, they're the ones you have to worry about.
So we are in a Gartner hype cycle with AI, as with all new technologies, where we get really high and then it goes down and then it comes back. I think we're now coming towards the useful part of it, where we don't have the high expectations it's going to take over for humans, and then I'm going to have a robot in the kitchen washing my dishes anytime soon, or a self-driving car that can come pick me up, take me where I'm going, and then I get out without any human intervention. That was another thing that really hasn't happened. But
we can talk about that later.
Well, we can talk about it now. But I do think that that doesn't mean that those cars aren't useful. So we learned that both Cruise and Waymo in San Francisco had far more human interventions than we'd expected. You know, back at the home office, the guy saying, oh, yeah, yeah, drive around that cone. We also learned, you know, Amazon just dropped their just take out stuff, right, where you walk out of the store, because it turned out they had 1,000 people in India looking at every single video to make sure that it was properly charged. It was very human driven.
Well, the reason I said talk about that is that one of the pitches that I made is I just did a story about the new Tesla, the 2024 Model 3, which, believe it or not, I bought, and much to the chagrin of many of my anti-Elon friends. And I, too, and, you know, the funny part is, you know, I was actually kicked off Twitter's safety advisory board by Elon. So it's not like I'm a friend of his.
But you have had multiple Teslas, right?
I bought my second Tesla. I know you had one and got rid of it, but I've been beating up on this new self-driving 12.4, the new version that actually came out like 2 days ago. And I have to say, Leo, you know, you can complain all you want and talk about all the things that it does wrong and can't do, but what it does is absolutely amazing. And you got to watch it. It can make a mistake, but it really does work. It even made a U-turn for me the other day, which is pretty, pretty awesome.
Wow. A three-pointer or all the way around?
I guess it was all the way around.
If it does a three-pointer, then I'll be impressed. You know,
remember, this is a car driving itself, a car that a consumer can buy for $38,000. That's what the new Model 3 costs if you buy the short-range version. And on any road. I mean, I drove it on dirt roads. I drove it on alleys.
Did you have 12.3?
I have 12.4. I had three, and now I have four. And
so that's what I'm asking. Is there a big jump? Because Elon's saying, like, this is, what did he say? V12.4 is another big jump in capabilities.
I haven't seen a big jump yet. I've seen some improvements, but I think 12 point whatever is a major light leap from 11. I mean, that's all I can say for sure.
Yeah.
Based on my testing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not about to sit in the back seat and let it take me somewhere. I'm definitely very much on top of it. But,
well, that's, I guess, what I'm saying. In fact, that's exactly what the point I'm making, which is we've tempered our expectations. We know it's not going to drive us everywhere.
Right.
It's assisting us, but it is a very useful partner in assisting us.
Well, frankly, unlike what a lot of people say, it's dangerous. I actually feel a lot safer, especially on the highway when I'm making a lane change and I've got all these cameras looking out for you to make sure that I'm not going to hit somebody as I make that lane change. So I use it and my eyes and my mirrors. And so far, it's never made a mistake on the highway like that. It once almost drove over a mattress. It has made some mistakes.
well, who hasn't? You know, almost driven over a mattress.
Exactly.
Right. Well,
It's never been a close call on a lane.
It's
change.
Okay if the mattress is in the highway. It's different if the mattress is at home. Let's just say there's a qualitative difference in the driving. I've had my car. I had a Tesla, which my wife called Christine, because it it would try to hit her in the head. It would drive her off the road.
Oh, yeah, you had
the
Model X.
Yeah, I had Model X. So that was a long time ago. That was 5 years ago or something. I now have an i5, BMW, which has also very similar ADAS, assisted driver stuff. But I was driving down the road and the freeway off-ramp came along and it started going that way. I had to grab the wheel. Mm-hmm. Nothing, but that's the thing. And I bet you, Larry, you don't close your eyes.
Of course not.
You're paying attention.
My wife does.
She's closing her eyes because she's in the passenger seat.
No, I'm paying attention.
You're paying attention and maybe even keeping your hands on the wheel. Unlike the Tesla, my Ford and the BMW have cameras watching you. And the BMW, man, you look over here, it goes, hey, pay attention. I mean, it really shouts at
Tesla,
you.
The Tesla has that too. It has both two things. You have to hold the steering wheel.
It's a torque sensor in the steering wheel.
Torque, yeah. And on the new 2024, the torque, you don't have to put as much torque, which is nice because it used to ding me all the time. And I had to tug my hands in the wheel.
Yeah, I don't like it.
It just doesn't know.
But, even my totally non-self-driving car does that. And it's annoying as heck.
I feel like we still have, this is still better than nothing. Or is it that the only risk is that humans will ascribe too much, that people will say, oh, I don't have to write songs anymore. I'm just going to have the AI do it, or paint paintings anymore. I'm going to have the AI do it.
Write articles.
I don't think the creative impulse goes away at all. I was thinking about this question of whether AI is art that I think Larry had brought up in our pre-show chat. You know, one definition of art is commercial art. It's the use of skill and experience to create, you know, an artwork, which might be like a logo. It might be a billboard. You know, it's not maybe artistic or artful, but, you know, it's like we need a lot of that kind of, you know, like artistic product.
Let me give you a good example. I asked Suno to make us some music on hold music. That's not art. Oh, that's not it. Where did I put this?
Music.
Yeah, Muzak. And you know what? It's fine. It's fine. It's now, if I were Kenny G, I might be a little worried. Okay. There are some kind of, there are people who make a living out of kind of generic music.
Leo, that reminds me of the time Marissa Mayer was CEO of Yahoo, and she got caught on a hot mic complaining about the hold music that that Yahoo was playing before an investor call. You know, and AI just had not arrived in time, you know, in timely enough fashion.
Here's the I think this problem. This is the waiting music that I had. This is AI generated. This is indistinguishable from the music I hear when I get a massage.
Or I was going to say, I feel like I'm in the spa.
It's in the spa.
It's
music.
Better than a lot of music.
But right, like, is Muzak art?
No, if you write Muzak for a living, I would be worried.
Hey, it's McDonald's food. I mean, how do you?
That's right.
How do you?
Well, yeah, and I mean, you're on to something. In addition to, you know, needing to worry about the socioeconomic damage that these tools are doing just by generating them, but also, you know, the IP landscape and personal data landscape is far from settled about all this.
Well,
what's going to be acceptable and what's not?
I know the patent office has said that you cannot copyright or patent an invention by an AI. That's correct, isn't it?
I'm not sure what the patent office has done.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the copyright office made a statement.
A copyright
along
office.
Those lines.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know about patents.
I couldn't have ChatGPT write something for me and then copyright that.
Right.
That article. What they're saying.
Correct. If it's solely, and Denise, please correct me if I've got the detail wrong, but I believe the copyright office has said if it is solely AI authored, it will not accept it. And if you used AI assistance, it wants you to disclose that. That's my understanding.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I feel like this is all a moving target at this point, that's one data point. But what I'm also driving at here is what, of course, trains these systems and how we're
I have a question for you,
coming to accord around that.
If I were to ask you, I don't know, who won the election? And I'm not trying to be controversial here. And you would say, oh, it was won by Biden. Did you actually look at the federal database that showed who won?
No,
good
point.
That because
good
you,
point.
You saw it on CNN. You read it.
That's
in
right.
Time.
I saw it in reliable sources.
Me,
yeah.
Right. If you were to read me the paragraph from The New York Times, which said that he won the election, then I could question whether that would be plagiarism. But knowledge is knowledge.
You
know,
in fact,
I know. I mean, I know what's going on.
We know
right
that
now.
Facts cannot be copyrighted. We know that.
Right,
that's
exactly.
Only the treatment of facts.
So how can companies like the New York Times or anybody else object to ChatGPT using their knowledge any more than if you or I were to say something that we know because we read it in the New York Times?
Right. Its lawsuit is about verbatim.
Right. Well, that
segments.
I
yeah.
And they had to really jump through hoops to create those verbatim segments. Things like, here's the first four paragraphs of the article. What would the fifth be? I mean, look, no one's going to do that to read the New York Times. They're going to buy the New York Times. This is a legitimate question if you're a creator. And we're all four of us are creators. We write, we publish, we work, we do work that is creative work. So I understand creators' discomfort. I guess the fundamental question, there's a couple, but one question is there a, because all a copyright and patents all about society's benefit. It's all about saying to a creator, okay, yes, you created it. So for a limited period of time, you get to reap the benefits of it exclusively, but ultimately it becomes part of the public's property and everybody can use it. That's why there's terms on copyrights and patents. And until that law, by the way, until that was established, creators felt like they owned it forever. So it really was an attempt to limit the power of creators to control their inventions so that society ultimately could benefit. I think this, now, and this is the fundamental question, does society benefit from AI ingesting this content? And then there's also the question, is an AI reading the New York Times any different from a human reading in a New York Times? Some say yes, some say no. So these are fundamental questions, I guess, as a society we have to answer. Denise, you're an attorney. Does the law speak to this at all?
Pieces of the law speak to pieces of this, and that's what's making this all really interesting right now, and trying to, you know, sort of shoehorn current reality into our existing legal framework and see how it goes. And right. I think it's just really interesting. And I'm not sure that there's a one-to-one match in all cases. You have an article in the rundown that I thought was fascinating about Vonna.
Yeah. Let me take a little break, 'cause that's a good yeah. place to pause. And we'll talk about that. I also want to talk a little bit about my experience in chess, because it's more than 20 years ago now that computer beat the best player in the world. Computers have widely, for 2 decades now, been agreed that computers are better than humans at chess. Go, something similar has happened. But I want to talk about something surprising that's happened in both games in just
a little bit. I must say, Bo, we're lucky to have a very wise and tech-savvy Supreme Court, which will clear this all up for us.
Oh, right? Lord. Well, that's a whole nother topic, not just the U.S. Supreme Court, but can courts and legislatures in general
right.
do a good job of this? And I think really it's societal mores ultimately they have to reflect. We have to decide as a society, and then the laws and the jurisprudence will reflect that. But we haven't even decided as a society what we think yeah. about this. And that's really what this conversation is for us as and our audience. You all are informed technology users. There's no agreement even among our panelists about this, but we need to come to some consensus before we can expect the law and jurisprudence to reflect that. So this is part of the conversation that has to happen. It's a good conversation. Denise Howell is here. Her new podcast is at hearsayculture.com. How's that going?
Yes, it's going well. The last time I was here, our feeds were not fully functional. Now all our shows have their own feed.
Yahoo!
I have two shows up on my solo show, which is called Uneven Distribution, and more in the pipeline that are coming out in the next month or so. And I'm doing I co-host a show called R&D with D&D with Dave Levine, who's been on our network here at TWIT a few times with me, and possibly on other shows too. He's a law professor.
I bet these are topics both of you discuss in these shows, right?
Oh, we certainly do,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, very timely. Hearsayculture.com for two shows. Glad to have Denise back on our microphones, too. Owen Thomas is at the San Francisco Business Times, part of bizjournals.com, bizjournals.com/San Francisco. Always a thrill to have you on. And Larry Magid, and we'll talk about what Kinnette Safely's up to in a little bit, because I know you always have great initiatives for parents and families on being safe online. Great to have all three of you. Our show today brought to you by Mint Mobile. I love talking about Mint Mobile. I like to surprise people with Mint Mobile's price. Any business that's doing things a better way so you can live better, I'm all for. Mint Mobile ditched retail stores and the associated overhead costs. All of that saves money. They pass the savings on to you. And, man, the prices are great. For a limited time, they're passing on even more. If you're a new customer, you're going to love this new offer that offers all new customers to Mint Mobile plans for $15 a month, no matter what plan you choose when you purchase a 3-month plan. Now, all Mint Mobile plans come with unlimited talk and text nationwide and data for $15 a month. And you can choose how much data you want for this $15 a month. But I can tell you, as a many-year now customer of Mint Mobile, it is the best. It's fantastic. I end up going with, I looked at what my usage was, and I ended up getting the, at the time it was only 10 gigabytes. That's the other thing. They keep increasing the amount of data you get. I have the 15 gigabyte plan. And it cost me like a quarter of what it was costing me from T-Mobile. It's an unbelievable deal. All plans are delivered on the nation's largest 5G network, T-Mobile. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan. They'll send you a SIM, or you can use an eSIM to activate it, which means you're going to take all your information, your apps, your contacts along with you. You can even port your phone number over instantly and painlessly. So you'll be basically saving money right away. ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited time deal. You'll get premium wireless service for just $15 a month for your first 3 months. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month unlimited wireless plan, just $15 a month. It's a great way to try it. Mintmobile.com/twit. Mintmobile.com/twit. And it's great. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month. Mintmobile.com/twit. Just so you understand, there's a $45 upfront payment required, which is $15 a month for 3 months. New customers on first 3 months plan only. You got to be a new customer. Speed slower when you go above 40 gigabytes a month on the unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. This is a great deal. They have a family plan, too. As I said, they have an unlimited plan. It is fantastic. Mintmobile.com/twit. It really makes me wonder why you would go with anyone else. Mintmobile.com/twit. Thank you, Mint Mobile, for supporting This Week in Tech. It's Vanna. V-A-N-A. What is Vanna?
Well, it looks like an interesting sort of, as Doc Searles would say, VRM play, where users are recognizing, hey, our data is our own and we want to manage it and we want to get compensated for it and we want to decide who's using it and how.
It's pretty timely. And, when Reddit IPO'd, they let us know that Google had paid them, I think it was $60 million for access to all the Reddit data. What is the Reddit data? Our posts. There is no data from Reddit. It's all the people posting on Reddit, just like Twitter and Facebook and everywhere else. So I think there were some people who said, gee, you know, why should Reddit make $60 million? So Vanna is going to, in theory, we'll see, wants to let you take your Reddit data and rent it out to train AI. And you get paid. Is this viable? Right. I wonder.
The problem I always see is that the actual value per user of that data is so minimal.
Yeah, here's your 32 cents.
Right. It's, you know, it's kind of like, you know, like Spotify royalties for most musicians, unfortunately. You know, it's not worth the cost of cutting the check, basically.
Now, I guess Google already has your data, but there are plenty of other people who would like to use that data who don't have deals with Reddit. So you could make them individual deals. And I would guess what Vanna wants to do. By the way, they've raised a lot of money. What I would guess Vanna wants to do is aggregate a bunch of people's data, right? And then offer it as a bundle to Hugging Face or whoever, or OpenAI, and then distribute it out.
I mean, the value of Reddit is real. If you do a Google search, often one of the auto suggests will be to add the keyword Reddit to your search. In other words, people have figured out that the general web search results Google returns are junk. What you want is the Reddit discussion about that topic.
Yeah.
And that will get you the real answer.
I have to say, I don't think Vanna is really viable for that very reason. But I do think it's important to recognize that that Reddit's making money on our data, as is Twitter.
For what reason? The money reason? The 32 cent reason?
Yeah. It's just too small.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just know. I don't know. I feel like this is looking at something that's going to be more widespread. And yeah, it's not going to be a lot of money, but anything that can replicate and give users more control, I think, is a good thing.
Yeah. Reddit banned the Vanna subreddit.
That's funny.
It's also,
I want to push back a little.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I want to push back a little bit on what Owen said about Reddit. Reddit has great information, but Reddit is made up of people. And unlike us, I'd like to say, unlike professional journalists, they're just people. They're great people and they're average people and they're trolls and they're idiots and they're liars. And, you know, they're just, you have to take everything you read on Reddit with a grain of sand.
Just like AI information, right? It's all hallucination.
Well,
all
like
And Wikipedia, you know, which is super valuable, but so you have to.
Did you? Yeah, that's right. I mean, humans are full of misinformation. Your neighbor, ask your neighbor of any variety of questions,
right.
And they will give you any variety of answers. And you would be prudent to suspect each answer, right? get, you know, but you,
why critical thinking is so important.
You made such a good point though, Larry, that we only know who won the election because we, not because we went to the federal election database,
right,
but because we read the New York Times or watched CBS Evening News.
Right.
We're trusting some other person to do that.
And in the case of the 2020 election, there are places where you might go and get the wrong information that millions of people believe.
Right.
And that's another aspect of this.
It does raise the question, what is truth? What is reality?
Mm-hmm. Virtual or real or artificial? Yeah. Or
you saw well, this. Go ahead.
I think that is something that all of the AI developers are concerned with as well, right? Yeah. That we're trying to give you something that is reliable and that you can, that it relies on information itself that is reliable. And I don't know, it's a huge mountain to climb, but necessary.
And it changes. As we learned during COVID-19, what science says is accurate on day one may be questioned on day two. Yeah. And, you know, that's just the nature of science as well.
Yeah.
Here's a challenging article from yesterday's Wall Street Journal. How I built an AI-powered self-running propaganda machine for $105.
Wow.
The author, Jack Brewster, calls it a pink slime site, which is, I like the name. He says he has no expertise. What he did was he went to Fiverr.com, which is freelance developers hang out there. He paid a developer, I guess $105, to write a website that would automatically take articles from mainstream news outlets, rewrite them according to a specific political preference, and publish them on the pink slime site. Within a few weeks, he said, I could even start earning programmatic ad revenue from my partisan AI content farm.
Mm-hmm.
He hired a guy with excellent ratings, 5.0 rating of 293 reviews, paid him $80, a young Pakistani. He said he's around 30 years old. He communicated with him via instant message. The programmer said, I'll create an automated news website auto blog. If you're looking for an automated website to generate passive income without any effort, my gig is your best choice. Here's his Fiverr. By the way, if you're looking for somebody, here's his Fiverr listing. he's an SEO expert. From there, all I had to do was answer a few questions about what kind of site I was looking for, the topics I wanted the site's articles to cover. The domain and site hosting added $25 to the total. That's where he got $105. Costs nothing to operate it. Runs itself automatically. Dozens of articles a day. In fact, this is one of 500 sites this developer has created. Each project takes him 2 or 3 days to complete.
You spend thousands of dollars on a web developer every year. I mean,
$80.
I'll be throwing away.
$80. So the site he created, which he doesn't put a link to, specifically designed to support one political candidate against another in a real race for the U.S. Senate. So he gave it a very specific focus, and yet he's able to get a dozen or more articles a day for this pink slime site.
He could have done this as a documentary to the various people with various agendas that are just out there doing this, not to show that it can be done, but for whatever their agendas are. So, I don't think any of us were surprised that this was possible or as easy as it was. It's you know, good that he's writing about it and
it's awfully easy.
More people aware. Yeah.
Here's the prompt he wrote for the AI. You have to write engaging news story of a minimum 300 words on the topic from a conservative perspective, promote Senate candidate Bernie Moreno, if you can. And the site is called the Buckeye State Press. Sounds legit. Buckeye State Press. I'd believe it. Ohio, big mm-hmm. senatorial campaign going on there. Here's a look at this. How is Bernie Moreno leading Ohio's preparations for Monday's total solar eclipse? Bernie Moreno upholds Ohio law on police cruiser window tint violations. How will conservative leader Bernie Moreno handle traffic during the April 8th solar eclipse? Very topical. Very topical.
Wow. What's amazing about this stuff is it's always been possible and it's always been done. But the fact that the technology makes it cheaper and easier and anybody can do it today.
Yeah.
That's the news story, really. The fact that he did this for next to nothing.
And to your point about critical thinking, if somebody's looking for traces of AI, it's not hard to find. Right. So this site isn't going to fool somebody who's looking for.
Who knows what to look for? Yeah.
Right. Who knows what to look for? For instance, in its version of an article, it took an article published from the Lorraine Morning Journal announcing awards for the state's top basketball players and rewrote them. In a stunning turn of events, Senate candidate Bernie Moreno has emerged as a strong supporter of high school basketball in Ohio. Particularly
stunning.
Stunning turn of events. Now, if you were a relatively eyes open reader, you might go, well, wait a minute, hold on. But maybe not. I mean, look at my in-laws would go, oh yeah, Bernie, he's great. He loves state high school basketball. Buckeye State Press rewrote an article about a winning lottery ticket, taking it from a Fox affiliate, TV affiliate in Cleveland, stating, as the excitement of the Powerball jackpot continues to captivate the state, let us also remember the importance of supporting leaders like Bernie Moreno, who worked tirelessly to ensure a bright future for Ohio. Go ahead.
So one interesting thing that comes to mind about this and relates to what's going on with Google and its various link tax struggles is there needs to be some vet of this kind of information that's out there. You know, what is Google going to make of this guy's sites?
Oh,
is it going to link to them? Is it going to show up in search results for news? I doubt it. I don't know what kinds of measures Google's ghost through to ensure that Bernie and his love for basketball get demoted to low ranking. But,
by the way, Jack Brewster, in an effort to show how easy this is to switch allegiance, then said, rewrite all of this to support Sherrod Brown, Bernie Moreno's opponent. And with a slight tweak to the prompt, the site began churning out pro Brown articles.
Yeah.
I think this is not new. This is only problematic in the volume and the ease with which it could be
and
done.
The cost. It's become so affordable.
Yeah.
I mean, that's almost the scary part. I mean, I love things being affordable, but it's scary to me that thinks that anybody with a couple of $100 can create massive amounts of misinformation in ways that will convince some people. You know, the barrier to entry is just low these days.
And the thing is, people are not going to go to a website like this and scour all the articles and look for patterns that give it away as AI. They're going to see one article in a social feed out of context.
Yeah.
Right. That's right.
I mean, I know, part of my job is keeping up with obviously business news in the Bay Area. I do a Google News search on terms like San Francisco, Bay Area, et cetera. And there are definitely sites that show up in the Google News search that I have not heard of, that I would not source a story from, and I can tell because there are like five repeats that there's some maybe syndication, maybe straight up copying going on. So, you know, unfortunately, Google News is not as trustworthy as I think it needs to be in terms of the sources it allows in.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually find my own articles sometimes plagiarized through Google News on sites that should not be ranked by Google News. I don't know how they got into Google News's database, but they're clearly plagiarizing.
Yeah, it'd be fun to talk to somebody from Google about that, because I remember back in the day, the very early days of blogging, when it was very hard to get your site or your outlet included in Google News. Yeah. And it was a big victory when you could.
Right.
And now maybe not so much.
I'll have to reapply because I got turned down the first time I applied.
Yeah.
Well, we're heading I'm going to take a break. We'll talk about this. The California Journalism Preservation Act. Our good friend Jeff Jarvis has written a really good piece about why this proposed link tax would not only not save journalism, it'd be bad for journalism. And bad for Google. And Google's response has been swift and I think a little terrifying. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. It's great to have Denise Howell here, hearsayculture.com, Owen Thomas from the San Francisco Business Journal, my friend Larry Magid, connecting safely, still connect safe. Is this full-time now for you?
Yeah, I do other things. I still write a weekly column for the Mercury News, but yeah, it's a full-time job.
Yep. It sounds like kind of almost a mission of love, like a personal mission as opposed to...
It is.
Yeah.
And it's just a great team of people, and to be able to kind of watch technology evolve and watch the risk evolve and also the ways in which we are dealing with them, it's been really interesting. I do enjoy it.
Have you written about or talked about Jonathan Haidt's book?
I have not published anything yet, but I've certainly talked a lot about it with a lot of people, and including some people who question some of his journalism and some of his research, I should say. You know, one of the things that Jonathan Haidt has done is he's seen a correlation between the rise of the smartphone and mental health issues. But as anybody who's taken a sociology course knows, correlation is not the same as causation. So he's not factoring in all of the other things that may be contributing to mental health issues, nor is he factoring in my opinion, all of the wonderful things that happen as a result of technology and young people having access to phones and social media. So it's very nuanced. It's not something that you can easily, you know, create a soundbite to describe what goes on in terms of youth and risk and technology. And unfortunately, I think he's got it boiled down to a very simple soundbite, and it's more complicated.
Yeah, we've talked about this quite a bit. On previous shows, the book is The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. And we also talked about Candace Oger's article in Nature. She's one of the researchers who says, no, it's correlation, not causation.
Exactly. It's correlation.
And,
for sure.
And Haidt has come on Twitter and has very strongly defended himself and saying, no, we have plenty of studies that show causation. It's so difficult. You know, I was talking to my son the other day about, you know, he's a big fan of the Huberman podcast and, you know, Noel Yuval Harari's Sapiens. I think I gave him Sapiens. And I said, you should always be careful when you read something that makes a lot of sense and just seems so right, to even more than you would normally vet it, because your natural disposition to go, that's got to be true, it just feels right. And of course it feels right that all this time these kids are staring at these little screens has to be bad for them, but I would say it requires even more proof.
Right, and it is bad for some people. Look, I like to think of it, when people say social media is like tobacco, I say it's more like chocolate. Nobody should consume too much chocolate. It's bad if you consume too much. Some people shouldn't consume chocolate at all, because, you know, they may have a medical condition or something that would make that very dangerous. But most people can consume moderate amounts of chocolate and be relatively healthy. And I think that you can point to some edge cases of horrible things happening that you can link to social media and smartphones. But you can also point to millions and millions of cases where horrible things didn't happen and edge cases where wonderful things happen. So, you know, yeah, there's probably some causation. But I think he oversimplifies the process based on my reading.
Yeah. It's worth reading the back and forth on Twitter, because Jonathan's really got a lot of points, but I think Candace Oger has points, and it's hard to know exactly what's right. Haidt says, look, because one of the first things we've all pointed out is this is the moral panic that happened when books started being published, when radio came out, when TV came out. You and I, Larry, grew up when rock and roll was causing our brains to rot. And it seems like every generation is upset about what the previous generation's into. Is just another moral panic. And he says, yeah, it's reasonable to say that. But on the other hand, sometimes things really are bad.
Yeah.
Like the rise of teen smoking or gun violence. And they really... You know, it's not moral panic. We should pay attention to them. And so that's the question.
If you go to connectsafely.org/moral panic, you'll find my presentation on the history of technology moral panics. And it goes back to Socrates worrying about the impact of writing on memory. And of course, the printing press, the loom, and the railway. You know, the railroads were going to create insanity because anybody who traveled at that speed was going to have a mental breakdown and probably attack people in the railway car. I mean, there's a lot of that. But on the other hand, you're absolutely right. We didn't worry enough about smoking. I don't think we worry enough about gun violence. We didn't worry soon enough about automobiles being dangerous. We are now. So, you know, yeah, there are things that are very dangerous. And there are dangers of social media. It's not 100% safe.
Right.
And I think if
chocolate's a good analogy. Yeah, I think that's a very good. By the way, this is a great little slideshow. This is a talk that you give?
Yeah, it is. It's a talk I've given a couple times now. Yeah.
I love this. I've been looking for something like this so I could use on the show because we talk about this all the time. Jeff Jarvis even has a little moral panic video that we play whenever.
I did a podcast with Jeff Jarvis. It's a part of our Are We Doing Tech Right podcast, and Jeff was
excellent.
Great.
Yeah, he's really good. Yeah, video games are going to destroy our youth.
And don't forget the millennium bug, what that's going to do to the world.
Yeah, right. And yet, it's reasonable to say there are things that can cause harm. And Haidt says this is one of them. So,
right.
I don't know.
Yeah, I think, I mean, his big thing is, one of his big things are getting phones out of classrooms. And I just, it strikes me as a really draconian solution. There may be very good reasons why someone needs to use technology in a classroom. Why is the computer in front of them much different than the phone that they would otherwise be using?
And,
you know, I mean, I just think it maybe is a too much of a soundbite and too much of a, okay, if we only do this, then we'll solve the problem. And I just don't think it's that easy.
It's a complex problem. That's really the truth. Yeah. Let's take a little break. We'll come back with more. You're watching This Week in Tech. Our show today brought to you by ZipRecruiter, actually a company we know a lot about. We've used for years. Have you ever, who hasn't done this, set your phone alarm to say, 9 a.m. Monday morning to buy those tickets the minute they go on sale, right? Because you know the bots are coming. If you don't get there fast, you won't be able to get those tickets or they'll cost an awful lot. Sometimes when you want the best, you have to act quickly. Well, guess what? The same is true with hiring. If you're hiring for your business, you want the most talented, the best people for those open roles, but you're competing with a lot of other companies that also wants them. How do you get ahead of the competition? Well, we use ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter has some really nice tools to make your listing pop out to the right people so you can jump the line and get the right people fast. Part of this is their amazing tool to find the best candidates for your job from their own database of applicants. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. Right now, you can try it for free, by the way. If you don't take my word for it, just go to ZipRecruiter.com/twit and try it. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. As soon as you post that job, that technology starts showing you qualified people for it, and then you can look at the resume and decide, gee, that's somebody I really want. If it is, you can invite them to apply. And I can tell you that puts you right at the top of the list because candidates aren't getting invited by companies like, oh, we really want you. And as soon as you do that, it's just natural. It's human nature. They go, oh, yeah, well, you really want me. I'd like to go to you. It's how you can get ahead of the other guys. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter. Find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Visit our exclusive web address right now and try it for free. ZipRecruiter.com/twit. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/TWIT. We used it for years. We're very happy with it. ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire. Thank you, ZipRecruiter, for supporting the show. Thanks also to our Club Twit members who make this show possible. We really appreciate your contributions. Times are tough right now in podcasting. A lot of podcasts going out of business. We decided a couple of years ago to ask you, our listeners, to support. And we're getting to the point now where, honestly, if we just had 1 or 2% more of the audience become subscribers, we wouldn't have to worry. We could create new shows. We could grow instead of shrinking. And really, that's the choice. If you like what we do, if you listen to more than one of our shows a week, please subscribe. It's only $7 a month. You get ad-free versions of all of our shows. You get the great Discord channel where you can chat with other members. You can see lots of material that we don't put out in public, including video of all the shows that are audio only in public, like Hands on Macintosh, Hands on Windows, The Untitled Linux Show, Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson. All of those shows are audio only right now for the public, but video inside the club. And it's just $7 a month. Yeah, $7 a month. Join twit.tv/clubtwit right now. Please, I beg of you. twit.tv/clubtwit. Your help makes a difference between shrinking and growing. We'd like to grow. I think now is a good time to grow, to be honest with you. I said I would talk a little bit about my own experience with AI and chess. I remember when Deep Blue beat Kasparov, the world champion. There was a real tremor in the chess world. Everybody thought, oh, that's it. The game's over. And who's going to want to play when you know a machine could beat you? And instead of killing chess, it actually, to some degree, boosted it. There certainly is an issue with cheating. It's a widespread issue, especially online when you're playing an online game, because it's hard to know whether the person you're playing against is using the help of a computer. But in head-to-head in-person board competitions, it's fantastic. I'm watching right now the candidates matches going on to choose the next challenger to the World Chess Championship. So as the strongest players, how many is it? Six, I think, eight of the strongest players playing each other head-to-head. It's really dramatic. It's very exciting. The commentators have access to computers. And when they show the screen, I'll just show you real quickly on YouTube. You can watch the play-by-play. When you're watching it on the screen, let me go back in time a little bit here. See if I can. Well, I'm getting the wrong video. YouTube's been doing this to me a lot lately. There we go. I guess the game's going on right now. You can see there's this bar on the left. White is almost has a won game, the computer says. Now, the players don't know. The players don't know what's happening. But the computer knows. And then afterwards, the players use the computers to do analysis, to look at what's happening. It's really cool. It's a really cool use. So the same thing happened in Go not so long ago. AlphaGo beat Lee Sedol, one of the top Go players in the world. And there was this tremor went through the Go world. Go is a Japanese game, much more difficult to solve than chess. It turns out, article in Scientific American this week, the AI's victories in Go inspire better human play. Go had been a little stagnant, apparently. People had kind of decided, well, this is the best way to respond in a certain situation. And seeing what the surprising, in many cases, moves that the computer used kind of gave a nudge to Go. And players are now more innovative. They are coming. This is David Silver, a researcher at DeepMind. It's amazing to see that human players have adapted so quickly to incorporate these new discoveries into their own play. The results suggest humans will adapt and build upon the computer's discoveries to massively increase their potential. I think that's very encouraging that AI, in at least these games, is not driving players away, but exciting them and stimulating them and giving them new ways to play and exciting new ideas to think about.
Right, and it sounds like it's almost serving a coaching function.
Absolutely.
For the players who are diligent enough to go back and review their games.
And believe me, if you're not, you're not going to do well in the world. you know, the best players are absolutely using computer coaching.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a history of this. I remember when it was presumed that the ability to communicate electronically would cut down on travel. And in fact, the travel industry is busier than ever. And has been on a steady increase, except during the pandemic. And so it's very often that we fear somehow technology is going to interfere with more analog experiences, you know, going out to dinner. There's so many examples I can think of that have not happened. And technology has actually correlated with better things happening than what was predicted, or what was feared.
And also AI in these games anyway isn't perfect. When you get to this level, at the highest possible level, sometimes the humans are better than the AI. Sometimes. Not enough to beat the AI. But enough times that you don't accept the AI suggestion always as the best move. So it's another case of human machine interaction that is actually beneficial to the humans, I think. Anyway, I said I would talk about that, so I bring that up from my own experience.
There are times when I actually find ChatGPT can do a better job than I do coming up with a particular paragraph or two. I've yet to see it write an entire article that I think is better than what I could write, but I find elements of it where, yeah, I wish I had thought of that. I wish I had been that creative. So, you know, maybe it makes me better at what I do. Maybe I have to work harder to compete against it.
And we are professional creators and communicators. And, you know, a lot of people are not that good at writing, say, an apology letter to their spouse.
I'm not good at that either.
Oh, boy. How about an apology song?
But I didn't mean to interrupt your point.
No. It's just that. It's like, you know, like most of us are not songwriters, but, you know, if you really want to say, like, I'm sorry, have AI write your spouse a song.
You know, in that presentation that Leo was showing you that I did about moral panics, all of the graphics were created using generative AI, and I couldn't draw a stick figure if my life depended on it. So that was an example where I did use AI to enhance a creative product in a way that made it a lot better.
Would you have hired an illustrator otherwise, or would you?
No, I would have had sucky images, or I would have had nothing, or I would have grabbed things off the internet. I'm not sure what.
I mean, I am concerned about, you know, there are professional illustrators who.
Right, that's the downside.
Yeah, Wired magazine, for example, said that they would not use AI generated images because they are, you know, they are in the business of creating not just words, but images for their covers, for their stories. Mm-hmm. And they said, no, we are going to pay humans as we have done, unless it is a story specifically about AI artistic output and, you know, what that looks like. And you need to actually show the thing that you're talking about.
Some of the images that I left in the presentation actually are absurdly inaccurate. And I did that to point out that they do make a lot of mistakes. And what was there? Was an image of Donald Trump and he had six fingers in his hand. Did anybody see that story?
Oh, fingers are like an infamous AI tell.
Weird. How
they're getting better. By the way, as soon as that became an issue, Stable Diffusion and others started training on hands. And they've got Midjourney and Stable Diffusion. Now you're rare to see a bad hand. That's almost a sign of previous generations.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting to think about, like, how as humans did we learn to recognize hands? By the way, humans are famously bad at drawing hands. Like,
it's hard. I can't draw a hand. Yeah.
Teach, you know.
Mickey Mouse has three freaking fingers.
Oh.
I really think that we're in this stage, too. I mean, we all remember when using a calculator or using a spell checker or a grammar checker was, you know, cause for hand wringing and possible accusations of cheating. And now I think it's come full circle. And if you don't grammar check your English paper before you turn it in, your teacher's going to go, why did you not grammar check this? You know, and I think that we're probably going to get there with generative AI as well.
Yeah. And I think the spell checker, you know, the calculator model for AI is a really useful one, and it should be kind of where we are leaning into, where we should lean into more, like where we should put more of our efforts as a, you know, as a technology industry into is, you know, what are the assistive technologies? If you think about, you know, an accountant having a calculator by her side doing numbers very quickly, like, can AI be like that? Something we have by our side, helping us, not replacing us.
No, I agree with you. What bothers me a little bit is both Microsoft Word and all the Google products will offer to write it for you. And that actually does concern me. The idea that they would buy almost by default saying, no, Larry, you don't have to write this letter. Yeah, we'll write it for
but
you.
But this is not aimed at you as a writer. This is aimed at business professionals who aren't writers and who want to communicate something. And because this is a business product, really. And maybe don't feel competent to create it or just want the assistance of the AI to write it. They may rewrite what the AI writes. I think this is very popular among business folks. Because
sometimes I'm on my phone and, you know, if the choice is like swipe to complete it with Gmail.
Oh, I always let Gmail complete it.
Right. The one thing that causes me concern about that in the business setting is people don't get as adequately trained as they used to, right? They can just punt on being able to do it themselves, right? And true. Let yeah. AI do it. And that's not great.
Well, but spell checkers has created a generation of kids who can't spell, right? Isn't
that's
that true? Does your son
I'm
spell
not
well?
That generation. I've forgotten how to spell.
Yeah, my daughter, I'm a great speller. My mother's a great speller. My daughter can't spell to save her life because she never had to. Mm-hmm. She just didn't.
Yeah, I mean, he's not as bad as he used to be. And he's got a vast vocabulary and
yeah,
he's
so
a
he
good
reads.
Writer.
Yeah,
yeah,
reads,
exactly.
He knows how to
yeah.
write. He just doesn't know how to spell.
I can't drive a wagon. And I suppose, 200 years ago, I would have had to if I wanted to get somewhere.
Yeah.
My point exactly.
Yeah. Were any of you the kind of kid who, would know how to spell a word but not how to pronounce it?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I still am. Sometimes
yeah.
Because you only read it in a book.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, of course, you can just find a YouTube video with the pronunciation of any word imaginable.
As a radio person, I have to do that often. Because there's a lot of names I can't pronounce just right. based on reading them.
And how do we bottle that secret sauce that we all trust those YouTube videos and they're pretty dead on? What means that they have to be accurate, but they are.
Yeah. There's some really good YouTube pronunciation videos out there. Let me just. I think. Let's see here. This is how to pronounce
You're
YouTube.
You're looking at how to pronounce the name of our favorite social media and platform. We'll be looking at how to say more brand names that too many mispronounce as well. So make sure to stay tuned to the channel.
Sounds like AI.
So how do you say yes. it? Well, there are at least two different ways of pronouncing it. Being owned by Google and started in the US, you could argue that it should be said the American English way, which is as YouTube, YouTube. So note the T sound here and the tube sound, YouTube.
I love that there's an alternate. I can't wait.
In the UK, it is often said as YouTube.
Tube.
Yeah.
Yes.
Tube.
Sound.
Tube.
Reason. YouTube.
YouTube.
British English. Or...
You know what drives me crazy about American that video? It's English, so typical.
You know more videos.
How do you pronounce Google? Wait a minute. Let's see.
Oh, God.
Google.
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 The name of the most famous and the most popular of all search engines in the world. We are looking at how to pronounce Google.
Google.
Go. Google. Here are many more videos.
Okay.
What drives me crazy about these YouTube videos, this included, how long it took them to give you.
Oh, I know.
I
know.
Is it
that
something
AI
like
likes to hear itself
longer?
Talk.
I don't know what it is,
but that's what happens when you reward stuff for like more ads if it's longer.
Right. Mm-hmm. Drives me nuts when I want information. I'm hoping I can read it, but Google always sends me to YouTube, and then you start out with the bumper, and then the guy has to say what's up, and then they take forever to tell you it. Then they have to pitch you on subscribing, and this is information that could probably have been translated in 20 words in a written text.
Yes. This is let me just see here. This is how you pronounce the names of famous actors.
Oh yes,
Archie Kid Kicker, Pitch Perfect Cup Song. Archie Kid Kicker. Archie Kid Kicker. Georg Clowney. Georg Clowney. Georg Clowney.
Yank Gyllenhaal.
This is one of my favorite YouTube channels. It's pronunciation manual.
Lepodio. Nyan nya o. Lepodio. Yeah, yeah. Oh.
Oh my God.
You know, Siri, no joking, does this all the time to me.
Oh yeah. It probably watches this YouTube video.
I've got yoga in my calendar, and Siri tells me, time to leave for Vinyasa.
CBS Radio in the day used to have people on staff who were experts at pronouncing things. I could call them up, and they would know how to pronounce any word or any language.
Is that like their full-time job, or is this just they're good at it?
I don't know. It wasn't the full-time job, but there was always somebody on staff that knew how to pronounce.
It's like the AP style manual. It should be a CBS pronunciation manual.
Exactly.
You've hit on something so cool there, and that is that technology gives birth to forms of humor that didn't previously exist. Yeah. That YouTube channel being a wonderful example. I think there's a lot more opportunities and outlets for satire nowadays than there used to be, just because it's so easy to publish.
Prior to YouTube, that could wouldn't even exist, right? You're not going to put that on CBS.
Right.
And I think that that's a problem with, it's kind of what you raised, Larry, with Jonathan Heights. There's also this huge benefit. You can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And in fact, I would submit, and certainly Jeff Jarvis does, that the benefit outweighs the negatives. We can find solutions for the negatives, but the benefits are amazing. You know, one of the reasons we talk a lot about podcasts struggling, but one of the reasons they're struggling is because there are so many of them.
Yeah.
Which is good.
Right.
You have, when I started, we were one of the first 10 podcasts in the world back in 2005, 2004. So there weren't a lot of choices. So we got a lot of listeners. But as time goes by, there are literally millions of podcasts. There's guaranteed at least one show that's just right for you. And it may not be ours. And that's fine. That's just, but, I would love it if there were only 10 podcasts in the world and I would have 1/10 of the audience, of the total audience, but it's not. And that's good. That's in the long run.
There was a time when there were 10 podcasts and you probably didn't have any audience at that point. I mean, the fact is that the audience is big and it's probably bigger, but.
Well, the pie is expanding faster. The slices are getting smaller.
Right.
Regardless. Right. We had more in the earliest days of in the first year of Twit, we would average 250,000 listeners. We're about half that. We're about half that.
Interesting.
But with the numbers we have now, given that there are almost an infinite number of podcasts you could listen to. I'm very grateful for those of you who listen to this one.
But my point is that there was a time when there were no podcasts.
And there were zero. I agree. Yeah.
The only choice you had was terrestrial radio, basically.
Right.
You want to listen.
As somebody like you who broadcast on terrestrial radio for years, I value the fact that there was nowhere else you could go. In fact, AM radio got hurt because there was in a big city like San Francisco, there were 70 stations and only five of them made money. Everybody else lost money.
And I happened to be lucky enough to work for one of the ones that was
one of the big ones, KCBS. And I was on KGO and KSFO.
First 10 podcasts, how many were about tech?
All of them. It was Adam Curry, Daily Source Code. Yeah. Actually, that's not true. Remember Dawn and Drew, the couple that lived in the Minnesota farmhouse, and they would talk about their lives? That was a very early show. That did very well. Mm-hmm. But most of them were about tech. Yeah.
That was back at the time, too, when you had the most followers on then Twitter.
That's a good example because in 2007, I think, Kevin Rose and I were in a battle for the most followers on Twitter. I had 5,000.
Wow.
And we were going back and forth. And then, and this is when everything changed, Ashton Kutcher showed up and he went to like 1 million. And it was a fight between him and CNN for the most. And Kevin and I were in the distant dust.
Used to be that if you Googled Larry, I would come out on top.
Right.
Very brief time.
Right.
And then Larry Page came around.
I was
David. Yeah.
No, I was the top Google result for Denise for many, many years.
Wow.
Yeah. But long, long ago.
Folks, you are listening to internet royalty. There you go.
Former royalty.
What is that? Am I on top? That's 32,000 followers. That's pretty good. I thank all my however many followers who actually bought a blue check because I am now, once again, without paying a single penny and without participating in Twitter at all, a blue check. Elon has brought back the blue checks for people who
How do you get that? Because you have so many followers?
This started this last week. 2,500 paid followers will get you Twitter Premium, and then 5,000 paid followers will get you Twitter Premium Plus. I'm proud to say.
But unpaid followers won't. Most of my followers, I'm sure,
they get you nothing.
Oh, I see. So it's all about how many of your followers have bought
the blue checks.
Wow.
I have 492,000 followers on Twitter. I'm sure 90% of which are bots. But enough. Actually, it used to be 550,000. So I think there's either people noticed I'm not here anymore. Look at this. I've deleted all my tweets.
Wow.
It's funny. I almost wonder like whether having a blue check is a good thing or a bad thing. I mean.
Well, okay. That's another development. So early on when he started giving people checks, a lot of people, Molly White and others, said, no, I don't want a check. You know, it's a mark of Satan. And then they would tweet things like, I didn't pay for this. Honest. And this happened, I think, on Wednesday or Tuesday. Maybe it was on Tuesday. One of our hosts was showing me how to turn off the blue check. So you can go into your account settings and turn off the blue check. But as it turns out, Elon didn't want you to do that. So he's taken that feature out. You can no longer turn off the blue check.
So. But he's so completely devalued the blue check in his kind of.
Well, he's trying to revalue it, isn't he? Right.
I guess, but how do you distinguish between someone who has paid for their check versus someone who has a certain number of followers who have paid for their check?
Right.
You know, and what is the honor of having 2,500 people who pay for their blue check following you? Like, why is that notable? I mean, I get from a financial perspective, at least that's more aligned than like, let's just verify journalists or let's just verify politicians. But you know, I think it's still very hard to convince X users that a blue check means anything anymore.
Right. Well, what it used to mean actually was simply that you are who you say you are, that you really are Leo Laporte, not somebody claiming to be Leo Laporte. And that's really that was the only original meaning of it. But it kind of became a status symbol after a while.
Right. And that's what Facebook and Instagram still operates in that ecosystem.
Right.
I wonder if what X has done has devalued the Instagram blue check. Like, are people less trusting of blue checks elsewhere because of, you know,
Instagram's blue check is expensive. Do you have a blue check?
You have to pay for it.
Oh, yeah.
I have one on Facebook that I didn't pay for. It just happened.
I think that's the original idea, right? Is that we have independently verified that this person is who they say they are. Right. That's the real value of it. Anything other than that. It's certainly
and I have to say, having had a blue check on Twitter and having a blue check on Facebook has not in any way improved my life.
No.
It doesn't mean anything at the end of the day.
No.
Other than you can't harder to impersonate you. Although people still do impersonate people. So.
Yes. I think that's a big benefit.
Well, you could pay $8 to impersonate somebody. That's the funny
thing. The key. They should vet. They should check your ID.
They don't.
They don't.
Yeah. Anybody can be anybody. Let's take a break, and then when we come back, I do want to talk about the California Journalism Protection Act, which is going to do anything but. And Google's response, which is somewhat draconian. Larry Magid, Denise Howell, Owen Thomas, great to have you. Great to have all you listening. Our show today brought to you by ExpressVPN, the only VPN I recommend, the only VPN I use. If you ever read the fine print, Google just lost a big lawsuit over this that appears when you start browsing in incognito mode. It says right there, your activity might still be visible to your employer, your school, your internet service provider. Incognito mode is anything but. And Google admits it. To really stop people from seeing the sites you visit, you need to do what I do. You need to use ExpressVPN. Think about the times you've used public Wi-Fi at a coffee shop, at work, at an airport. Terrifies me. Without ExpressVPN, every site you visit could be logged by the admin of that network, even in incognito mode. That does nothing Do you really want anybody anywhere to see what you've been looking at? It also exposes you to security risks. If there's a bad guy in that same network, there's all sorts of things they can do. What's more, your home internet provider at all times can see and record your browsing data. And in the U.S., they're legally allowed to sell that data to advertisers. That's a big profit center for all the big ISPs. That's why at home, at work, on the road, at the airport, at the coffee shop, you need ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN encrypts all of your network data, reroutes it through a network of secure servers so that your private online activity stays just that, private. There's an app for all your devices, even things like smart TVs. They sell routers, but it'll go on many other routers. It goes on Windows, Mac, Linux. It works on iOS. It works on Android. The app is great. It has a big button. Turn it on. You tap to connect, and your browsing activity is secure from prying eyes. It comes up for me all the time when I'm at airports especially. I'm always very nervous. Always turn on ExpressVPN. When we were in Mexico, I used ExpressVPN to watch TV in the U.S. because I couldn't watch it in Mexico. There's just a lot of reasons why it's a good thing to have. Just have it on your device. You'll be glad. Stop letting strangers invade your online privacy. Improve your security. Avoid geographic restrictions. Protect yourself at ExpressVPN.com/twit. ExpressVPN.com/twit. If you use that link, you'll get 3 extra months free with a 1-year package. It brings the price down below $7 a month. It's very affordable and well worth it. ExpressVPN, ExpressVPN.com/twit. ExpressVPN.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support. Somebody is telling me that, in fact, I didn't know this, when you sign up for a paid account, Twitter asks you for ID. So I mean,
he's good.
If you say you're McLovin, I'm sure you are McLovin. Who else would you be? Right? I have seen lots of complaints on Twitter about the really draconian captchas that Twitter uses. And you have to do dozens of them. It seems, at the very least, annoying. Let's talk about the California Journalism Protection Act. Google has decided this is kind of a shot across the bow, right? A little warning shot. Because California state legislature is considering the CJPA, which would create a link tax that would require Google to negotiate a fee to sites that it shows snippets for in its search results. Google says, and this is in the Keyword blog, we've long said this is the wrong approach to supporting journalism. If passed, here's the shot across the bow, CJPA may result in significant changes to the services we can offer California and the traffic we can provide to California publishers. They are, just to demonstrate, right now, for a limited number of users, no longer sending those users when they search for news to those sites, which they've tried. They did this in, Spain? I think they did it in France, and it's always been very effective. Now, you have a site that probably benefits from Google's search traffic, Owen, but also probably would love some revenue from Google. Where do you come down on the CJPA?
I think in this case, I really can't speak for the San Francisco Business Times or our parent company, because those decisions are made like way above my head. But I will say this is kind of the playbook that Google and Meta have used in Australia, Canada, Spain, other jurisdictions where there's been some proposal for a link tax, and it has usually led to led to publishers backing down. I also question whether, and again, not speaking for myself or my own, my own personal interests here, but I question how important news content is to Google's business.
Well, we know Facebook was happy to turn off. They don't care.
Yeah. I mean, what Facebook has said, and they've played this out in newer products like Threads, is that, you know, like, hey, political content is a turnoff. It generates division. Like, people just want to relax, hear from their friends, you know, have a good time, see pretty photos. And I kind of get that. You know, Google has even talked about a real phenomenon, which is that a lot of people, especially younger users, have kind of news fatigue where they are, you know, like the news is a bummer and, you know, they, you know, again, especially political news. I think, you know, business publications like the Business Times might be in a different situation because we're serving readers who have an active need for the information we're giving them. And, you know, because we are paywalled and people are generally subscribing to us and seeking us out, maybe visiting us directly, we might, you know, a publication like that might in theory be less affected. But, you know, I think it's, I think there are serious questions about the future of news and how it gets funded. I'm not sure that Google really serves itself in the long run by threatening to not serve readers search results that those readers want. That seems like a pretty strange and self-defeating response.
So can I get into the nitty gritty here, the details? I haven't read the proposed act yet, but Leo, maybe you know just from the coverage. You said something about snippets. So is that the issue, that portions of the articles are being shown and might discourage people from clicking through and actually going to the site? If they're just using headlines, is that a better solution here? Sorry, Leo, you were up. Did you even hear me? No, I'm not sure he did.
Google says,
yeah.
And I credit them a little bit when they say this. It was certainly the case in Australia where it was Rupert Murdoch and his newspapers that were lobbying for this. Google says in their keyword blog, it would favor media conglomerates and hedge funds who've been lobbying for this bill and could use funds from the CGAPA to continue to buy up local California newspapers, strip them of journalists, and create more ghost papers that operate with a skeleton crew to produce only low cost and often low quality content. They say this is a grab by the already successful rich publishers. It's not to support journalism. It's to support them.
You know, as a not rich publisher, I'm very grateful to Google driving traffic to either it's my site, or if I write for a while there with writing for Forbes, and, you know, where I got paid based on traffic. And a lot of my traffic came from Google, and I appreciated it. I'm not sure I fully, maybe Leo, you just gave the explanation why these conglomerates are so opposed to this, but to me, it's free advertising. Now,
you would think that Google, and this is Google's point, we drive more traffic. Watch when we turn off the spigot, see how you feel, right? That's
right.
That's why they do that.
I'm always excited when my stuff comes up high on Google News.
It's right.
You know, I love it.
And I this is why I'm asking you guys, because look, if they did it a podcast, I might have a different point of view. But I don't think the snippets that they publish are sufficient to keep people from visiting the site, or are they?
And on the snippet, I mean, if you're looking for just a headline, who won the election, and that's all you care about.
You don't need more, and you probably wouldn't visit the site anyway.
Yeah. Right, you wouldn't do it. Yeah. But if you care about why they won the election, you're going to want to read on.
And, you know, isn't the issue that journalism, you know, the journalism industry should be worrying about, isn't it more like the wholesale usage of articles by AI models, where there is no intent of ever sending you to the website? You know, well, Google at least is trying to send you to a publisher's website.
They don't like that either. I mean, the New York Times is suing OpenAI over that. So you're right. That's another cause for concern, but I'm sure they're able to be concerned about two things.
Well, the other issue, there's a lot of free stuff out there. And if all you want is a shallow, you know, kind of rendition of the news from a site you might or might not be able to trust, you're going to find it anyway. I mean, certainly if you look at CNN's free, I think we'll continue to be free. There's a lot, which is a legitimate site, but there's a lot of stuff there that you can get anyway. And I think that if these big sites start basically getting blocked from Google, it's going to hurt them in the long run.
Right. I think people know by now, I am not a huge fan of Google anymore. I think Google has become... and shitified, frankly. They're going for the profit, at the cost of users. In fact, there was a new study just came out from researchers at Leipzig University. They asked the question, is Google getting worse? We've all kind of anecdotally, I think, experienced this. You know, the Google search results are worse than they used to be. They examined 7,392 product review queries on Google, Bing, and DuckDuckGo, and they did it over a year. The research showed spam sites are hyper-prevalent, showing up at the... So Google's not doing a good job of blocking spam, showing up at the top of Google rankings in what is, quote, a constant battle, end quote, between the sites and search engines. In other words, they write, search engines seem to be losing the cat and mouse game that is SEO spam. I also just think when you go to a Google search, I don't use Google anymore. I use a page search site called Kagi, K-A-G-I, that is, Harry McCracken, my friend, recommended this, and I've been using it, and it's not, I think it's $10 a month, but there's no ads. And so, you know, if you search for tennis shoes on Google.
A lot of ads, a lot of sponsored hits.
That's an ad. That's a Nike ad, I think. Dick's Sporting Goods. The organic search results are well below the fold.
Yep.
Right?
It's also true on Amazon. If I'm looking for a particular product at Amazon, I've got to hunt through all of these would-be products that are trying to capitalize on that product name to find the one that I actually want to buy.
In fact, at this point, Google's turned this into a shopping site. It's even got the Amazon-style filter by department, brand, price. I mean, this is a shopping site. Google's put together a shopping site. Now, maybe because I'm searching for tennis shoes, Google reasonably says, oh, well, obviously you're in the market to buy tennis shoes. We should show you our Google-crafted shopping site, I guess. Let me go to Kagi and do the same search, see what I get. Again, I pay for this. So there's no ads, but this is more what I would. This is like how Google search results used to be. In fact,
I'm
still getting
PageRank.
Yes, this does not use Google at all. I'm still getting, by the way, Nike and Dick's at the top based on PageRanks. I'm getting some listicles, but I think I'm getting more organic search results here at this point. A lot of stores, some articles about tennis shoes are actually showing up. It isn't quite so clearly a shopping site. It's probably because it's tennis shoes that it's really looking this bad. But I don't know. I feel like Google. Am I wrong? Is Google not getting worse?
Well, I answered my own question on the actual text of the proposed law.
Oh, good. Let's go back to that. Yes.
And it doesn't distinguish between snippets or links. They're all included.
Well, see, a link is not stealing any traffic at all.
Right. So the text is whether the platform links to, displays, or presents an eligible digital That's journalism absurd. Providers, news articles, works of journalism. And if they do, then they're subject to the tax.
So that's clearly a grab, a money grab, right? Because... a link doesn't in any way hurt you. It only helps you. And so they basically want Google to pay for the links to news. Google says only 2% of our search traffic is about news, by the way.
And, you know, the eligible digital journalism provider, that, you know, I wonder about that because there are a lot of upstart news sites that are filling in news deserts, right? They're maybe small nonprofit newsrooms, former journalists, journalists who formerly worked at a mainstream newspaper that cut jobs starting their own publications. Who is deciding who's
there are tons and tons of definitions in this proposed law, and an eligible digital journalism provider is an eligible publisher or eligible broadcaster that discloses its ownership to the public. That seems weird. Definition.
That's hedge funds, right? I think Google is fairly credibly right that this is something written by hedge funds who want to use this as a way to jumpstart.
I'm not sure,
Okay, here we go. More definitions. Qualifying publication. They're just trying to they're trying to have a pretty broad definition here of who's going to get
as long as the people who wrote this, the lobbyists who wrote this, get included, they're probably happy.
Right, exactly.
Denise, are there First Amendment implications in having to disclose your ownership?
That's interesting. And I think there are First Amendment implications, and Chumley pointed this out in IRC, of the government telling Google how to present its search results. You know, arguably its commercial speech.
Yeah. Jeff Jarvis wrote a analysis of it, which he had published on his Medium blog, if you want to read it. He was commissioned to write this, we should point out, by, let me see if it says, was commissioned by the California Foundation for Commerce and Education, which is basically the California Chamber of Commerce. They did not exercise control over the content, although they did compensate Jeff to write this. But he wrote a very nice, I think, and it probably worth your time, especially you, Denise, as an attorney, 41-page summary of what this is and why it's bad for journalism.
Yeah, we'll definitely read it.
Yeah, it's on his
Medium. Can we go back to that 2% thing? That boggled me.
Do you think it's true?
It's not true in my case. I mean, I think I primarily use.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Right. No, I primarily use it to find articles I can actually access that aren't behind a pay and or subscription wall.
Yes, but we are, you know,
oldsters, news. Olders.
Well, also we are news publishers. We're, you know,
yes.
All of us, I think, have some role in identifying, selecting and presenting news.
That's true. Yes.
Well, also being interested in news. I mean, I go out of my way several times a day to find out what the latest news is on a variety of subjects. And my daughter, on the other hand, does everything possible to avoid finding out what the news is because she doesn't want to be bummed out by it.
No, you know what? I'm kind of with her. I stopped.
It's a real phenomenon. It's called news fatigue. And it is something that, I think publishers really ought to wrestle with more of. You know, it's like if people, if a segment of consumers are like actively turned off by your product, what are you doing?
Here's the quote from Google's keyword is well known, says Google. It's always suspicious when instead of citing actual research or stats, they say, it's well known. It's well known that people are getting news from sources like short form videos. Actually, TikTok is actually a big source of news for millennials and Gen Z, topical newsletters, social media, and curated podcasts. And many are avoiding the news entirely, just like your daughter.
Yeah.
In line with those trends, just 2% of queries on Google search are news related. Now, Google does have a news app. They have a news site. I'm like your daughter in the sense that I stopped watching 24-hour news channels. Really bad for my brain. But I know what's going on. I get the headlines. I on my phone. I read newspapers. I actually prefer long form magazines because it's a little more thoughtful. But I certainly know what's going on, and I get alerts. I got an alert yesterday when Iran launched drones against Israel. The minute it happened, so I'm not avoiding news. But what I am avoiding is the Sturm und Drang, the outrage engine that a lot of news.
I need to go on a 12-step program for cable news. I mean, I actually
it's bad
have cut
for you.
Back.
It's bad
I,
for you.
I consume far too much of it. I know.
And I love it. But at the same time, I know it's been, it's like very much like Twitter, which is totally addictive.
Can I just anecdotally share with you what I saw on CNN that as the eclipse was about to happen?
What?
They brought on not an astronomer, but an astrologist.
Oh, no. Are you kidding me?
And they said, well, the moon is in the seventh house and Mercury aligns with Mars.
And there was some sort of saying, well, so many people are looking to astrology now. This was their justification of the story. And they felt they did need to justify it.
Yeah.
And so I assumed the story would be on that, the sociological impact of the eclipse on people who look increasingly to astrology. Nope, it was the moon is in the seventh house.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
Pull it up. It is. If that doesn't tell you about cable news jumping the shark, I don't know what does.
Do they still call themselves the world's most important news source or something like that?
I don't know.
The world's most important news network.
Yeah.
Get off the 24-hour news train. Nothing's going to, if anything important is happening, you'll find out, Larry. You really will.
Yeah,
you don't have to, you know, Anderson Cooper does not have to tell you.
Are you kidding? He's one of the more credible ones. It's the Morning Joe that I got to get away from.
Oh, stop it. Yeah. Jeff watches that too. And it just, see, it gets me angry. I feel my blood pressure going up, my stomach in knots. It just, it's upsetting. And by the way, that's not by accident. It's everybody working in broadcast news knows, and I know I used to work in broadcast news. You did too. Yeah, that
absolutely.
The way to keep people listening is to get them either scared or upset or outraged, but that keeps people watching and listening.
That was, you know, I was actually interviewed to be on Oprah to talk about internet safety, and they did not put me on the air.
You weren't outrageous enough.
To say that going online is going to, you know, result in being, you know, assaulted by somebody. I wouldn't.
Right.
Buy into the hype, and they didn't put me on the show, and I've had that experience with a number of networks.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know,
they know,
right.
They're not. Look, we think they're in the news business. They are not in the news business. They're in the entertainment business. They're in the eyeball business.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons, by the way, we promote the club. I want to get out of the eyeball business. Right. I don't like being in the eyeball business, but let's take a break.
In order to sell commercials.
In order to sell something, only because I need to. Until you guys all pony up, I'm going to do the ads. You know, what's different about us? You know, I worked in radio where it was 19 minutes out of a 60-minute hour of ads. That's one-third ads, right? Right, Larry? Mm-hmm. It's just nonstop. And I always said, we're never going to do more than one ad every half hour. And we stick to that. And we also turn down a lot of advertisers, which, by the way, they're baffled by that. I remember I was at an upfront in New York City. Our agency flew us out to speak to an upfront, which is where shows go. In this case, it was a podcast upfront, but networks do it too, to pitch their year ahead and to get advertisers to buy ads. And my interviewer said, well, do you ever say no to ads? I say no to more ads, and I say yes. And the audience, which is filled with advertising agencies, there was an audible gasp. They said, you say no? Yeah, we say no all the time. We say no either because we don't want to do the ads or because we don't think we'd be helpful. We literally turn down money because we don't think, you know, companies that are selling jewelry, for instance, or a woman's shoes will come to us and we'll say, you know what? Thank you. We'd love your money, but we can't take it because we're not going to do very well for you. It's, you know, unless we think we can do well for you, we're not going to do it, which is why the predominantly you'll hear ads about security, networks, technology and stuff, because that's who we talk to. And we're very careful only to put sponsors on that we believe in. Like,
you don't take drug ads, right? From like
no drug ads, no vitamin ads. We did vitamins. I kind of regret it. We're not going to do them anymore. We know vaping, no e-cigs, no cryptocurrency. So we have whole categories we say no to.
I'd like to see drug ads.
Sadly, no hair care tools.
I do love that water brush, and I love the curling iron. You know, those aren't ads, though. That's real endorsements from real users.
Every time I see a drug ad, I'm convinced I have that disease.
Oh, I know.
And I have to worry
about see, again, 24-hour networks are watched by people our age, Larry,
right.
And we need our medication. And so 90% of the ads on those things, you know, and it's will cause sausage fingers, your hair to fall out, you may die, but your skin will be clear and beautiful.
My favorite one is Viagra. Viagra will make you sexually potent, but you'll be bald.
Yeah. So your choice.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Which would you like? Yeah. Don't get me started. But we are very careful. We like our advertisers. We're very happy. And I will tell you about one that I think the world of, and it's NetSuite. In fact, NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system. You're talking accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all in one platform. Well, you know what that means? One source of truth. The less your business spends on operations, multiple systems, the less they you spend on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have, the more money you keep. But how do you reduce costs and headaches? Well, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle, the number one cloud financial system. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because you're not running it locally. It lives in the cloud. No hardware required. You can access it anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems. You have one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes under one roof into one platform, slashing manual tasks, slashing errors. A single source of truth makes a huge difference. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you can profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. But don't delay. Now's the time. Head to netsuite.com/twit. N-E-T-S-U-I-T-E. netsuite.com/twit. Flexible financing for a few more weeks at netsuite.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support of This Week in Tech. FCC has now mandated. FCC's, it's very interesting watching the FCC these days. They're oh, who's that? Hello, puppy. Is that your emotional rescue animal, Owen?
Actually, I'm his emotional support human. This is Fitzgerald Quimby.
He's very
You sweet. Realize this is unfair competition to the rest of us. There's no way that Denise and I can compete with a cute puppy.
I have mine in the next room. I can go grab her.
Oh, you might be in trouble, Larry. I have mine in the next room as
dog
well.
Dog on dog.
You might be in trouble.
He's being very patient.
I have to
bring
my granddaughter.
Oh, your granddaughter will win.
But Leo, you were talking about the Furry Critters Commission?
Yes, that's it. The FCC, the Furry Critters Commission. They are bringing back net neutrality, which is interesting. It also has some interesting side effects, but I like this one. They are now mandating nutrition labels for broadband plans. Major ISPs had until April 10th, just a couple of days ago, to publish labels at point of sale with the information you need. Things like, well, how much bandwidth am I actually going to get? How much data is included with this plan? Are there limits? What's the price? Is it an introductory rate? If it is, how long does it apply for? What is the price after the introductory rate? How long is the contract? What are the additional charges? Do you charge me for a modem? Do you charge me a device installment fee? Do you charge me purchase fees, backup fees, termination fees, government taxes? What are they going to cost? This is great. Thank you, FCC, for finally, this is do the right thing.
Can I be a cranky consumer for a second?
Yes.
What is with the, like, broadband caps? Like, I believe that the modern internet was built on, like, you pay a monthly fee, you get all the internet you can consume. Yeah, maybe speeds are limited, but it doesn't feel right to have a cap on your broadband consumption. I get that, like, there might be people who are, like, running services off of, off of their home computers, and, like, they probably need to be switched to a commercial plan because they're actually running a business off of their home internet connection. But, most of us, like, what are we doing? We're sending some emails, we're browsing the web, we're streaming Netflix. Like, calm down, broadband providers, with the data caps. This has been my cranky consumer rant. Thank you for listening.
No, it's funny because Dvorak and I 15 years ago had this fight. I would say it cost them fractionally incrementally to give you bandwidth. The bandwidth is not the expense. It's the infrastructure they put in the first place. They cost you almost nothing to give you additional bandwidth. This is a money grab. I've said that for years. Dvorak said, no, it costs them money. It doesn't cost them money. It's like a water company. The water is practically free. It's the delivery that costs the money.
Well, there was a time when you had to pay for long distance calls. And I used to wonder as a kid, does it really cost a lot more money to get a call from LA to New York No. You know, it was like $3 a minute.
It's a
or
good point.
Right? You know, and but the other question I would like to see on this broadband label for consumers is an understanding about how much speed you actually need. Now, I have to admit, I bought the gigabit service and, you know, because I wanted it and I do some uploading. But the reality is that most of us can get away with without far less speed than that and not notice a difference. And I think people are paying for speed that they don't need.
I remember looking into my Wi-Fi router and the speed it could support. It was like, oh, I definitely don't need to pay Comcast more because I couldn't, you know, it's like all of that speed will be stopped at my Wi-Fi router and I won't ever see it.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly what I was going to say. A lot of equipment can't support 5 gigs of internet speed.
Tesla likes to talk about how fast its cars go, but nobody in the right mind would ever drive their car 160 miles an hour on a public road.
It's bragging.
There are people who aren't in the right mind that do. But
when I bought my Model X, I did buy ludicrous mode, and I used it for demos. Right, I would say, okay, hold on, sit back, relax, and then. And I stopped doing it because I almost blacked out a couple of times. And I thought, no, this is too dangerous. It's such a silly thing.
People paid a lot of money for that.
I paid a lot of money, thousands of dollars. Yeah. It was dumb. The FCC is looking into this data caps thing, actually. They announced this last year. I don't know what the outcome has been, but they actually have a data caps experience form at FCC.gov because they're trying to, I think, collect data so that they can perhaps go after this. So your hopes may be heard at some point. It's been a year. I don't know. They are going to do a vote April 25th to restore net neutrality protections and to reclassify broadband as a Title II service. This was, of course, the big kerfuffle back in the Trump administration when they turned that off. Now, I think we all thought the sky was going to fall. I don't suppose it did, although I can't think the prices went down as a result of eliminating net neutrality. But I'm glad they're bringing it back. In principle, I absolutely support the idea that a bit is a bit.
You know, it's funny. When I used to do radio shows about net neutrality, the analogy I use, it would be as if the public highway charged you extra money to drive in the fast lane.
Right.
Well, guess what California
they
has just
They do that,
done, right?
Yes.
They do that
all
now.
All over the place.
I want road neutrality.
Yeah. So under Ajit Pai, originally, Title II, it's a complicated, long story. Title II reclassification was granted in 2015 by Obama's Open Internet Order, later repealed by Ajit Pai. That's the current state. But on April 25th, the FCC wants to vote to restore its authority to regulate Comcast, AT&T, T-Mobile, and to regulate net neutrality, restore net neutrality. I hope that will happen, and I think it will.
The thing they seem to be most concerned about is these preferential deals with providers like Netflix, for example.
Zero rating.
Yes, exactly. To they come in under your cap and don't count.
And it's hard to explain to consumers why that's bad. Because on the face of it, sounds pretty good, right? I mean, I can watch Netflix on my T-Mobile and it doesn't cost me extra? Mm-hmm. Sign me up.
Right.
Why is that bad?
But a lot of that bundling, you know, never came to pass. Look at AT&T spinning off Warner Media, now Warner Brothers Discovery. Like that combination of a telco and a media company just didn't work because, frankly, the investment profile, you know, the deep capital expenditures in telco and then the, were kind of at odds with the way media needed to spend. Obviously, Comcast is kind of an example of a cable company and a media company that have been successfully grafted together. But there are very few other examples of that kind of working.
I have HBO free with my AT&T plan because it's grandfathered. But now you could no longer get that. No matter what AT&T plan you're on, you're not going to get free HBO anymore.
Right.
Now, Benigno,
and Leo, you're not going to be someone who's going to be zero rated for a consumer. So, I mean, that's one way in which it's bad, is it makes it hard for you to compete.
So if Spotify got zero rated, let's say, and so in fact, it may be, I don't know, on T-Mobile, they may give you a free, not only give you a Spotify account, but then say, and you don't pay for the bits. So you don't have to worry about hitting a broadband cap or bandwidth cap or anything, because we'll give you the bits for free. That's called zero rating. That sounds like, on the face of it, a consumer would say, hey, great, I can listen to Spotify. But we're not Spotify. Joe Rogan gets a benefit because he's Spotify exclusive. So it doesn't cost you anything to listen to Joe Rogan. But you start listening to Twit, suddenly it costs you something. That's the problem in a nutshell.
But you can be Spotify, right?
Actually,
you
I think
can
we put are a feed Spotify, up there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's exactly. A bad example. But you get the idea. It's that if you zero rate some players, those players are, and usually their big players, are getting a leg up over any incumbent or any innovator that wants to come and challenge the incumbent, any competitor. But it's hard to explain. You could see why it's hard to explain that.
But would Spotify come to you and say, like, hey, Leo, here's an offer you can't refuse. We're going to take 70% of your advertising revenue.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. You
know, yeah, we don't actually, we're on Spotify as all podcasts can be, but we don't charge through Spotify because, they would take too big of a chunk.
It is hard for consumers to care about, say, the negotiation between a Comcast and a Netflix over what Netflix pays.
Yeah.
And it's about these fees that are kind of charged in the middle of the network when traffic's being exchanged, and it has a lot to do with, like, how much is going upstream versus downstream, and it is important, but it is really opaque to the consumer. Like, even the, even those nutrition labels wouldn't really shed any light on the impact of net neutrality on, like, the everyday consumer, what they pay.
And we were talking about this on Wednesday, and Benito, our technical director and producer, hi, Benito Gonzalez, talked about, see, in the U.S. we have a different experience, but his experience in the Philippines is very different.
Yeah, so in the Philippines, you can, you can still get that open internet experience. Like, but most of, like, sort of middle class and higher class folks will get, like, your regular DSL fiber internet. But most people who get their internet plans from their, straight, like, all their internet comes from their mobile phone. Like, they can purchase a plan where they get zero data, but all of Facebook is free. And that's what they opt for most of the time. So their whole internet experience is Facebook.
And Facebook subsidizes this. In fact, this was what Facebook offered India. I remember India said, no, we have experience with colonization. We're not interested. But Facebook was offering something called the internet that was really basically Facebook, right?
It was AOL.
Yeah. The whole idea of it was, look, developing worlds, we will offer you connectivity. And it wouldn't just, here it is, it's still there. They called it internet.org. The idea is, in the developing world, we'll provide the bandwidth, no problem. But the bandwidth is essentially a walled garden where it's Meta and then a few other services, not Meta, to give you the feeling that you're doing the internet. But what you're getting in the Philippines, if you're doing that, is not really the full, broad, open internet. You may not even get Twit. Right.
Yeah, you're not going to get anything. Right. Well, if you subscribe to one of those plans where you don't have data, but Facebook is free. That's how it's promoted. It's like, you don't get data, but Facebook is free.
You don't get data. That's really zero rating, and that's the end game on zero rating, and really a big part of the problem. I agree.
So I looked up these what do we call them? Nutritional labels that are now mandated for the ISPs, which look great. And AT&T has rolled them out, as they had to, by April 10th. So I'm looking at the ones for my neck of the woods. And unfortunately, there's a lot of fine print. So maybe people don't read through everything. But the thing that just leaps out at me is that all of AT&T's available plans, and they start, this is for their fiber, they start at $80 a month for 1 gig and go up to, I think it was $225 for 5 gigs, which many people may not have equipment that will work with. So aside from that not being disclosed, all of the plans are described as unlimited data. And as far as I can, I don't see anything here about throttling.
They may be like, they, you know, it's funny because I, at one point, I got an email from Comcast saying, you've gone over a terabyte this month. We're going to let you go over a terabyte two more times, but then we're going to charge you extra. I should check because, you know, I didn't pay attention. And it may well be that we're paying a higher tier. That's what happens now. They don't throttle you anymore. They just charge you extra. They charge you.
You get so your speed stays.
Your speed stays. You get better service for more money. It's a weird situation.
That's new.
Because we have Sonic fiber here, and it's 10 gigabit symmetric, but we don't have much hardware that can use it.
Right.
And right up front, at the top, AT&T says no data caps. So maybe that's
why how they do it, maybe. Let's see what's going on here. Speaking of AI, SAG-AFTRA.
By the way, unlimited data. I just looked up the original announcement between AT&T and Apple of the iPhone plans.
Yes.
They're all described as unlimited data.
And it was.
I get a monthly text from AT&T about, you know, like, we're going to throttle you if you...
Well, that was changed.
You would have had unlimited data if you hadn't canceled that fine plan that you got back in 2007.
I've kept that very expensive plan this whole
time. Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Wow, you never canceled.
Oh, so now they're maybe taking it back.
Yeah.
Randall Stevens, who was the CEO of AT&T at the time, said it was the worst thing he'd ever done. In order to get the iPhone, they had to offer unlimited data. And he said it cost us so much money. he said it was the worst thing I did in my tenure at AT&T.
It was a fun time to have an iPhone then.
And so many people stayed grandfathered in. I'm impressed, Owen, that you were able to keep that. I guess
I only canceled mine like in the last 2 years. I had it for a really long time too.
Here he is. This is back in 2012. AT&T CEO, unlimited phone data was a big mistake. I lose sleep over iMessage. He's no longer the CEO, I might add. And here, by the way, in the Cult of Mac column from 2012, it's a picture of Randall Stephenson with the subtitle, Randall Stephenson is playing the world's saddest song on the world's smallest violin. the good old days.
You have to remember how weak AT&T was at that point and like how much the iPhone contributed to its comeback.
It was really
a second rate player in wireless, or, you know, seriously playing catch up.
He only did it because he had to. It wasn't like he ran to Steve and said, I'll give you free data. They needed it. They had to do it. On stage interview at the Milken Institute's global conference, he said, my only regret was how we introduced pricing in the beginning, because how did we introduce pricing? $30 and you get all you can eat. And it's a variable cost model. Every additional megabyte you use in this network, I have to invest capital. Aww.
Well, he had to build up his infrastructure, but it paid off in the long run.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So big deal.
Absolutely. That moment, I think, was part of the BlackBerry movie, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
What a great movie that was. I think it's pretty accurate, but they show how Steve Jobs met with Sam Sigman, who is the chief executive at Singular, and talked him into offering the iPhone. And at the time, BlackBerry thought, nothing to worry about.
No. Why would anybody want a phone without a keyboard? It makes no sense at all.
Makes no sense. SAG-AFTRA has made a deal, I'm happy to say, for its movie star and TV radio stars in the union, which I used to be, but no longer have to
Me
be because I'm not on the radio. Do you do enough radio that you stayed in the union?
I'm still a member, but I'm not, you know, I'm not doing much anymore.
I guess I'm technically a member, but I'm on abeyance.
Yeah, like, I'm on some kind. I don't get the, you know, it used to be the big benefit of being a SAG-AFTRA member.
I know what you're going to say.
Awards. And you got the screeners.
You get the screening DVDs for the SAG.
But now who needs? Now it's all screened anyway, so who cares?
In fact, that was always the best part of being in a SAG-AFTRA member.
Yeah,
you go to the mailbox and there's all these DVDs. But even before I quit, they just send you codes, and it was like not as good.
Right.
So
and now most of them are already on Netflix or
by
Amazon
now
Prime.
They're out.
So
yeah.
Who cares? Yeah.
Yeah. Actually,
it was fun for a while.
Big news for the geeks in our audience: Dune 2 comes out on streaming on Amazon Prime tomorrow. Mm. Tomorrow. Have you seen Fallout yet? You guys aren't that type.
I have.
No, I totally am. I've been meaning to watch it. I haven't seen it yet, though.
Benito, you saw it, huh?
I saw, yeah.
I've watched the first two episodes. See, I loved that game.
So did I. I mean, personally, this is probably a hot take, but I hate that there's canon for this game because the old games didn't have any canon.
Canon, you don't mean like big guns that shoot giant
no,
balls.
No, I
you
mean like what happened before the
Bible, yeah. You mean. The Bible of it. What they did, though, that which is great, is they captured the kind of tongue-in-cheek retro-futurism style so nicely,
yes, that was
I
great.
Thought. And the thing to me that made Fallout so fun to play was living in that weird post-nuclear apocalypse world where they still listen to 1930s music, but they've got robots.
Yeah, my headcanon for that was that it's post-Doctor Strangelove. That's what the Fallout universe is.
Yeah, yeah. They're all wearing these giant Pip-Boys on their wrists. These giant wrist, you know, I've got more power in my Apple Watch. But no, in those days, they wore a giant thing on their wrist.
Because it was a CRT.
Yeah. They had a CRT on their wrist. It's so much, to me, it's really fun to watch the show only because it's that world. I didn't play enough of the games to know if it's actually the game. It's not the same story, is it?
Well, see, that's where I diverge, because like the story changed after Fallout 3, because that's when it changed hands to Bethesda.
Wasn't it isometric at first? You were looking
down. It used
down
to be a
it?
Top-down isometric view, yeah. Made by Black Isle, and the original creator is Brian Fargo.
Should I play the old Fallout versions before I watch the show?
I don't know. I think this makes more of a nod to like the new Fallout.
So yeah.
Like
Fallout 3, I played Fallout 76 and I liked it. It was fun. I know there were issues with it. But
well, I'm going to jump in here and say I don't think many of the people who fell in love with The Last of Us were probably players of the game, right?
Now, Last of Us followed the game. I mean, it actually had the plot of the game. Mm-hmm. I don't think this has the plot of Fallout, of any Fallout game. But there's the vaults. It's fun. I think it's great, by the way. Incredibly violent. But funny and good. I think it's very good. Did you watch the whole thing, Benito, yet? Or
yeah, I finished it.
Worth watching?
Sure, yeah. It was fun.
You're not thrilled with it, though?
It's just, that's very much a personal thing. I know that's not like a real thing.
You liked it. So if you really liked the games, you might not like it.
Well, I was just a big fan of the original, like Fallout 1, Fallout 2, Fallout Tactics.
I might have to get, you can get them on Steam, and I think even Xbox, you get the older games.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Or GOG.
Oh, good old games. Yeah. GOG. Okay. That might be fun.
When are they going to make a Civilization?
They have. Like, it's the History of the World Part 2. Mel Brooks did it. It's done. It's over.
I think having like maniacally nuclear happy Gandhi would be that's going to be a real winner. That could be real popular.
Is that where you take your Civ 5? You go Gandhi, you make him a nuclear power. Is that what you do?
There was this weird bug in Civ where Gandhi, as like a peace loving leader, would like flip over to like extremely warlike.
Yeah, this was a bug in Civilization 1 or 2 where Gandhi just came out like
nuclear Gandhi.
He was a war freak.
What?
Yeah. And they just made it a thing.
They like promoted. They said, good. Oh, that's we're going to lean into that bug.
You don't want to make Gandhi mad. It's kind of the civilization rule.
Galia says it was an integer overflow. That makes sense. So he went so far to the left on nonviolence that he flipped over to violent. That makes
sense. Yeah.
Well, back to our point about humor over the years and how it changes with technology. I'm wondering if anyone's seen the Steve Martin documentary.
Yes, of course. Yes. Love Steve. Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful documentary. Did you like it?
Yeah. I loved it. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, he was like my second dad as I was growing up. My naughty second dad who told jokes my real dad wouldn't tell.
Naughty and wear arrows through his head and make balloon animals. And, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a wonder. It's really a wonderful show. It makes you fall in love with them all over again, really.
It really does.
Yeah. Let's take a little break. We got some final words with our wonderful, esteemed panel members. But first, a word from Wix Studio. Now, I've been going around looking at websites and web creation tools, and I got to say, Wix Studio blew me away. I only have a minute to tell you about Wix Studio. This is the web platform for agencies and enterprises. Here are a few things you can do from start to finish. I got 60 seconds. Let's see. Let's go. Adapt your designs for every device with responsive AI. How about that? Expand Wix Studio's pre-made solutions with back-end and front-end APIs. How about that? Generate code and troubleshoot bugs with a built-in AI code assistant. Switch up styling of hundreds of web pages, I mean, talking fonts, layouts, colors, all with a one click. Add no-code animations, gradient backgrounds. You can do that right in the editor. You could start a design library. You can package your code and UI in reusable full-stack applications. Oh, and one more big one. You can deliver everything your client needs in one smooth handover. That's just not enough time. But the list keeps on going. There's so much great stuff to love about Wix Studio. Here's the thing I love. Every site looks like its own unique snowflake. It's not a cookie-cutter solution, and each one of them is unique in its own right. Step into Wix Studio. See for yourself. Go to wix.com/studio or click on the link on the show page and find out more. W-I-X, wix.com/studio. Thank you very much. A little obituary for a legend in physics. The, I guess, inventor? Can you say inventor? God invented the Higgs boson, but Peter Higgs discovered it. Shall we say that? Passed away at the age of 94, won the Nobel Prize. It's a great story because he theorized the existence of the Higgs boson in 1964. He said it helps bind the universe together by giving particles their mass. But, of course, in 1964, you're not going to, hey, there it is. There's the Higgs boson. We didn't know. I remember very well when the Large Hadron Collider in CERN in 2012 began experiments. And there was some concern, by the way, at the time that they would somehow create antimatter and blow up the world. But they didn't. And they discovered that Higgs, Peter Higgs, was right. There was, in fact, a Higgs boson. Amazing that, you know, 40 years after his original discovery, 48 years after his original discovery, experimental physics would prove him right. Pretty impressive. The Higgs boson still bears his name. He got a Nobel Prize. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences said at the time, the standard model of physics, which underpins the scientific understanding of the universe, rests on the existence of a special kind of particle, the Higgs particle. This particle originates from an invisible field that fills up all space. Okay. Even when the universe seems empty, the Higgs boson is there.
And we are more connected as a result of Higgs. CERN, which was, you know, founded largely to pursue this research, also created the World Wide Web.
Right. That's right.
And it was largely to share scientific data around this very research. That was the kind of immediate need.
Isn't that great? Yeah.
But now we have the whole, now we can share, you know, cute dog videos.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Tim Berners-Lee is still around and being very active in the development of the World Wide Web. So that's cool.
But also how wonderful that Higgs lived to see his theory borne out.
Yeah. Yeah. Apparently very unassuming, quiet guy, kind of a Steve Martin of physics. Right. Didn't wear our arrow through his head, but kind of an unassuming, quiet guy who got the recognition he deserved, which is always nice. And as long as we're talking science, I don't know. You know, a lot of times I read these stories, nothing ever comes of them. This is kind of interesting from Science Daily. An improved charging protocol that might help lithium ion batteries last much longer. Sounds like you're familiar with this, Larry.
Well, it's funny, having a car with a lithium-ion battery, what I want to know is, where do I buy this charger? So I literally have a brand new, I actually opted So they have two different technologies on the Tesla. They have the LFP, which stands for, somebody tell me what it stands, something phosphate, which is a, doesn't degrade as fast, but it's also a smaller battery, so it doesn't give you as much range. Or you can opt for the lithium ion, which gives you a longer range but faster degradation. And it sounds like this is a cure to the degradation. And if I'm reading this right, in theory, you should be able to buy a charger. I suspect this is years away from commercial exploitation, but one should be able to extend the lifetime of any battery if this research is correct and somebody builds a product that actually bears it out.
Batteries like ours are charged usually with a constant current. When you plug in to your charger, there's a constant flow of electrons. A new study by HZB and Humboldt University in Berlin says that's not the best way to charge them. They say you should pulse the electricity, pulsed current, clear differences between the two. In constant current, the solid electrolyte interface at the anode was significantly thicker, which is one way the capacity gets impaired. But pulse charging led to a thinner SEI interface, fewer structural changes in the electrode materials, speeds up charging, but more importantly, makes the battery last a lot longer. Doubled the life cycle.
I just Googled pulse battery charger. I guess there are products that claim to do that. So I'm going to
look into it soon. Yeah. Denise, do you drive an electric vehicle? Or are you still gas bound?
I am gas bound, but my next vehicle will at least be a hybrid, I'm pretty sure. I have an e-bike, so I'm curious about extending its battery life.
Everybody who drives an electric, car or bicycle, in my experience, goes, wow, where have you been all my life? It's they're fun. Don't you love your e-bike?
Oh, I love my e-bike. Yeah.
Where do you live, Denise?
I live in Newport Beach.
Okay, because I live in Palo Alto, where unless I go into the hills, it's flat. So I haven't bought an e-bike because I don't need an e-bike to ride around flat land. But it is great when you are in hills. It's terrific.
Harry McCracken rides his e-bike all the way from down where you are, all the way up, all across the Golden Gate Bridge into Marin, has a cup of coffee and rides back on his on his e-bike. Because, still paddle, you still get exercise. It's not
a car alternative.
It's a great way of getting around.
My son bought one because he didn't want to buy a second car for him and his partner.
They have
an e-bike and a car.
Right. I find I actually get more exercise as a cyclist on my e-bike because, like you said, there are hills that I just couldn't navigate without its help. And with its help, I can still get exercise on those hills.
My heart.
You know, I couldn't imagine going back to a gasoline car. I mean, hybrids are great. We have a Prius. We love our Prius. It's a great car. And frankly, we don't buy much gas for it. But I just love the fact that I can fill up at night. Every night I fill up my car, and the next day I've got a full tank of electricity. Of course, not everybody lives in their own house. If you live in an apartment, it can be much more challenging.
Well, I got to point out, you live in an area where gas prices are actually close to $8 a gallon now, right? They've really gone up. I saw a Redwood City gas station. It was $7.50 a gallon.
Let me feel better about my electric bill.
It's a very nice feeling to drive by that $8 a gallon.
On the other hand, if you're using superchargers or if you're charging and paying for it on the road, you actually are paying sometimes as much as gasoline, depending upon the pricing.
We got 60 solar panels. We got two Tesla power walls. We charge, almost always charge at home.
You're driving on sunshine.
Sunshine.
Yeah, hear me out.
Make a song on that. Yeah.
Crazy idea. What if we took a car but made it like more of a shared vehicle with capacity for, 50, 60 people?
You mean
electric? And we, instead of having to charge it, you had continuous power through an overhead line.
Wow.
I could beat you on that. What if you dug holes, bored holes, if it were, into the ground and took that 60-person car and drove it through the ground so there was no congestion? Now what are you talking? Now what do you say?
Wow.
Okay, but to get more efficient, why don't you take those rubber wheels and make them steel?
Oh, my God.
Since it's a dedicated pathway, put steel rails, so steel wheels on steel rails.
Or what if you bored a long tunnel underneath the city of Las Vegas and you took Teslas and you drove them slowly Oh, and you could have a flamethrower too.
You know, the flamethrower is the pièce de résistance of the whole Elon.
Can you guys see that word processor over my shoulder that doesn't require batteries? It works as unlimited charging
Incredible.
That is amazing. So is it biologically powered? Is that
you? That's right. It's actually, in fact, I burn up calories every time I use it.
It's finger power.
It's almost a hybrid between a Peloton and Microsoft Word.
This reminds me, there was a Dennis the Menace. I don't know if anybody here remembers Dennis the Menace, but there was an episode like when I was a kid. And Dennis went over to his neighbor, Mr. Wilson's house, and Mr. Wilson had a carpet sweeper. And Dennis couldn't believe that he could operate this carpet sweeper without plugging it into the wall. And what an amazing invention that was.
So, he just pushed it, right?
Just push it. It cleaned your carpet.
Ladies and gentlemen, I know these are all flights of fancy, but maybe someday we'll have something we can wear on our wrists with a little cathode ray tube that can tell you where you are at all times. It's just a dream, but it's my dream. Thank you, Denise Howell. Her new podcast. I'm so thrilled that you finally got a feed for it.
I'm so thrilled myself.
Say Culture. There's two of them. There's R&D with D&D, Dave and Denise. And yes. Is Technology Helping or Hurting Us is the latest episode. You also did one about NFTs and yes. Then Uneven Distribution, which, of course, is a play on the classic William Gibson comment, the future's already here, it's just not very evenly distributed. Denise talks about the future. Move fast and break things, all in, all out. Please hold the fallout.
Yep.
Oh,
yep.
You did one
That's
about
Dave
fallout.
Sifri, by the way.
Oh, I love Dave. Oh.
Yeah, Dave is my most recent nice. Guest, Good. Most recent show.
Fair. What did you guys talk about besides fallout?
We talked about AI
nice.
And various AI tools that Dave has been working on, including one called Questy, which is pretty interesting.
I haven't heard of him since Technorati, so he's still he's still very active out there. That's great.
Very active out there, yeah.
I love hearing that. People say that about me all the time. They go, what have you been doing since Tech TV 20 years ago? Nothing. Mm-hmm. Nothing important. Denise, thank you. It's always a pleasure. Any hair products you might recommend I should buy for my wife, just let me know, okay?
Yeah, no, I've already downloaded all of my knowledge to you. So anything else comes up, I'll let you know.
Thank you, Denise. Mr. Larry Magid, longtime CBS radio commentator. You still hear him from time to time there. President and CEO of Connect Safely, connectsafely.org. If you hear a clacking coming from the office, he's typing, boys and girls. Okay.
Well, if I can promote my own podcast, I have a new one. It's called Are We Doing Tech Right? It's connectsafely.org/podcast if you want to bring it up. And we have interviewed everybody from, Vint Cerf and Leonard Kleinrock, the creators of the internet, what would they do now? We recently did one with our friend Jeff. I'm blanking his last name.
Jarvis?
Jeff Jarvis.
Oh, there that guy. Jeff Jarvis, Jeff.
How to Dodge Techno-Moral Panics.
Nice.
Youth Mental Health in the Age of Cancel Culture. That's another very recent one. So you can get these wherever you get your podcasts. And, of course, at connectsafely.org/podcast.
Nice.
Yeah.
Congratulations. This looks great.
Yeah, no, it's doing very well. We're really enjoying doing it.
Cool. Thank you, Larry. Great to see you. You know, I find that podcasts scratch many of the radio itches, as it were.
Yeah. I get to use this. I paid all this money for this big microphone.
Use your mic. That's right.
You get to use it. Yeah.
You get to use it.
But I don't get to use my ISDN line anymore. You're the only one listening who knows what that is.
I know. In fact, did we turn ours off?
You still have one?
We had one until we ended the radio show. It got turned off. But we still have the Comrex boxes in case they ever need it.
Oh, I have to tell you, my box is at the Computer History Museum. I donated it. CBS didn't want it back.
Oh, that's awesome.
So it's on display.
In the days of broadcasting, Larry Magid would use this box to communicate with the world.
That's right.
And it's because it was symmetrical, right? Symmetrical up and down?
It was reliable. It was a direct line, and it actually worked every time back when the internet didn't work so well.
But you're right, Denise. It had two 64K channels, So it had enough bandwidth to send high quality audio down, but we also would get high quality audio back. And for call-in radio and stuff like that, it was a necessity. Yep.
But did you have a hybrid?
Yeah.
Telephone? Yeah, I have one of those. I still have one of those.
Yeah.
I could
eventually
use it with my podcast.
Premiere, which owned the radio show, got tired of paying for an ISDN line, and they got more expensive because the phone companies really did not want to keep those switches. So they replaced it with a Comrex, which used the public internet. Oh, my God. Right. Where the public goes, and it worked just as well, and it was free.
But the main thing, we're doing this show on Zoom. On a product.
This is the public internet, folks.
And it works.
It works amazingly.
Video. Yeah.
It's kind of, when it doesn't work, it doesn't. But most, 90% of the time, it works great.
Oh, more than that, yeah.
By the way, Leo, as part of the copper line switch off, ISDN lines are going away.
Yeah, I figured. Yeah. When? Oh, yeah. Do they give a timeline?
Whenever regulators allow AT&T all to...
Because they have to, it's still using copper lines, but it's using a separate kind of switch, and usually, I knew towards the end to get the guy who knew what that was. There was like one guy in the whole office, who had a little closest, and he go, "Can you give me the ISDN guy? Who's that?"
CBS paid $3,000 for that box that I gave to the Computer History Museum.
Oh, mine was seven. My Zephyr was $7,000. Wow. Yeah, it was very fancy. I think we still have the Zephyr, right? Did we send it back? We have two Zephyrs and how many Comrexes? Two? But I didn't know I could give them to a museum. Did you get a tax break?
Well, see, I didn't own it. CBS.
Ah. Ownership of these devices is unclear. Right. I don't think Premier wants them back.
under the tax law, Trump's tax law, I'm not entitled to breaks anyway unless I itemize. So that's a whole other show.
Forget about it. I did my mom's taxes yesterday. I don't do mine. It's too complicated. We have a business, but mom's relatively simple, but complicated enough that I couldn't use the easy. And of course, I'm using TurboTax.
Right.
And every 5 seconds, you could for a couple $100 more, you could have some help. I don't want any help. It would only cost you $93 more if you just got... By the end, it's incessant upsell. And it costs
$200. Did you see the IRS? The IRS is beta testing their own tool for simple taxes.
Not in California yet. No. I'm hoping by next year, or Rhode Island, where I was filing for my mom. I'm hoping by next year I won't have to pay TurboTax. It kills me. $200.
Wow.
Yeah.
I bought the downloadable version.
The tax code changes every year, Larry. That 1975.
No, they update it.
Oh, they do. They okay. All
right. Yeah, no, it's always updated.
Really? You could do a box? I'm just doing it online.
No, you can download it and then they update it.
They don't they? They charge you for e-file. They charge you for the update. They're getting their 2 cents.
Yeah, no, they get plenty of money.
Yeah. Nonstop upsell. Owen Thomas. Go ahead.
We had to end on tax day.
No, we're not. No taxes. If you haven't done them, you have till tomorrow.
Yeah.
I put it off the last minute for my mom. The only reason I keep using TurboTax is, because she's older, she has to required withdrawal from IRA. So she has an IRA and the TurboTax just logs in and gets the data, downloads it. I have to edit.
That's so magical when it does
it's
that.
Really
I have a,
it's
I have nice. A. An investment account, and it just sort of magically puts the information
saves
in
saves me a lot. I mean, there's foreign tax credits. There's all sorts of weird stuff, and I don't have to do with it. So I guess it's worth $200. Owen Thomas, he should know more about this because he works at the San Francisco Business Times. He is the guy. You can find his writing at bizjournals.com/San Francisco, or just look for all over the city, little blue kiosks with the... Right? Are they blue?
I don't think we have any street distribution
anymore.
They
used to have little blue boxes. Oh.
Yeah, no, it is a largely subscription
but they still print it.
Subscription circulation. They do still print it.
Nice.
And we're having to change our print format because it's hard to find printers actually.
I bet. Yeah.
Yeah.
Always a pleasure, Owen, my dear friend. It's great to see you. I don't get down to San Francisco much anymore, but I hope the next time I'm at the Golden Gate Theater.
Hey, hey, and make an appointment with John at Joe's Barbershop before.
I will. Love the haircut. John at Joe's Barbershop. I went to a kind of a hipper place. They all have like their Instagram handle over their chair, and they gave me a fade. And I think at my age, it's not the best. Now it's grown out and it's now a problem. So I don't know what to do.
You dye it gray?
Yeah, I dye it gray because I want to have the. I actually worked with somebody at Tech TV. I'm not going to say his name, who dyed his temples gray so that people would trust him more.
I grew up in the inn.
Kevin Rose.
No. No, no, I'm not going to say any names. It wasn't Kevin. I'm not going to say who. thank you, Owen.
Yeah.
Thank you, Denise. Thank you, Larry. Great to see you. Thanks to all of you.
Always a pleasure to begin this show.
Always fun. I love doing this show, and I thank you for being here. I thank our audience for letting me do this. I thank especially our Club Twit members for paying me to do this. We do This Week in Tech every Sunday, 2 to 5 p.m. Pacific time. That's 5 to 8 Eastern time. That's 2100 UTC. You can watch us do it on YouTube, youtube.com/twit. Or if, you know, you want to be more convenient, you can go to, there's a YouTube channel after the fact. You can watch the video best, or you get it from the website, twit.tv. Best thing to do to go and subscribe in your favorite podcast player. That way you'll get it automatically the minute it's available. I guess we should have kind of a little party because in 3 days, it will be the 19th anniversary of the very first Twit. Episode one was April 7th. Am I right? Was it April? Let me look it up. I have to do this every time. I think it was April 17th, 2005. Yes.
Wow.
Patrick Norton, so cool. Kevin Rose, and Robert Herron.
Wow, you're almost the same age as Connect Safely. That's great.
You're older than that? Jeez.
We were technically the end of 2004.
My first podcast.
You know, what's a decade here and there?
My first podcast was 2004, was The Tech Guy in, I think, October, September 2004. But Twit really didn't exist until we started doing Twit. The first one was called The Revenge of the Screensavers. And then I got a cease and desist from Comcast. and I asked the audience for suggestions. Somebody said, how about This Week in Geek? And I thought, that's good, but I don't like geek. Maybe This Week in Tech. And I liked the acronym Twit. And yes, it's intentional. I still get email to this day. You know, Twit, that's a pregnant goldfish, you know, or it's an insult in the UK. I know. It was a joke. It was a little, we were being self-deprecating.
And then someone made you a magnificent logo and it was set in stone.
Dorothy Yamamoto made me a wonderful, beautiful logo, which is to this day lives on. That little guy with the eye that's got the little legs.
And some other guy claimed to be the chief twit of another company. Yeah, that no longer associated with twitting.
I complained about it, and I am convinced he won't take credit for it, but he won't deny it either, that Jason Calacanis, who is intimate friends with Elon, went to him and said, Elon, you can't be chief twit. There already is a chief twit, because he only did it for a few weeks, and then he changed it.
And you're not going to change the name of your company to X, right?
I think I might. I'm actually considering it right now. Thank you for joining us this week in X. No, see, X is a terrible name for anything. It's not a
The logo could cross its antennas.
Elon briefly called himself the chief twit. But I think I have a feeling somebody got to him because he didn't do it
pretty good.
I hope so, because I was getting mad. And I won't go into the history, but we have Twitter and I have a history.
Yeah, Elon and I have a history too.
Yeah. Well, I want to hear about that sometime.
Not that kind of history.
Oh, okay. thank you all for being here. Really appreciate it. It's been wonderful. 19 years. We start our 20th year next Sunday with an open house. April 21st. If you haven't yet gone to the survey, tickets.twit.tv. I would love to see a full house for that show, because I guess that will be the official birthday. But actually, Wednesday is the 19th birthday of This Week in Tech. And you know what? For 19 years, I've been saying it. I'm going to say it again. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time. Another Twit is in the can.
This is amazing.